Welcome to Between the Sheets, episode 50. Yes, we've made it to 50 shows, almost a year. And we are discussing the week that was June 28th through July the 4th, 1988. See, we told you we were going back to the 80s last week, and we did it. Thank the Lord. We got some little different things going on. But, yeah, should be a good show this evening. I'm your host, Chris Zellner, joined by my co-host, as usual, David Bixenspan, who, you know, I always joke about Bix having every writing job on the internet just about, got another new job this week that I'm sure he'll want to tell everybody about. Bix, I know you're excited to have this new venture.
Yeah, with lawsnews.com, which is part of Mediaite and all of those sites, I had a job interview with TV's Dan Abrams and everything, and yeah, so I'm going to be part-time there on top of everything else starting the day after this comes out.
Now, of course, this is not the live audio wrestling law. This
no,
is like
no.
The actual law.
Yes, but it does have a Z.
Yes.
It's Law News with a Z.
Yeah, it's like Scoops with a Z. Or News with a Z.
It is News with a Z.
I know, but it's like the... So are you guys like copying and pasting what like other major newspapers write, like the wrestling news sites do?
Thankfully, no. Thankfully, no.
Okay,
I think it's just that someone else owned Law NEWS.
Okay, well that's good. That's
I know
good.
It's a relief. I mean, you'd have to worry about that type of thing when you see the NEWZ just on reflexively from being a wrestling fan, but that's not the case here.
So how much do you owe your job to Hulk Hogan?
A decent amount, probably.
Yes, for the Hulk Hogan Gawker lawsuit stuff, which you did great work on. So, yeah. So, good luck with that one. Another new job for Bix. All right. And our guest this evening. Yes, we do have a guest. First-time guest. A guy that, you know, both of us have done podcasts with. Me, of course, quite a few podcasts lately. From the Shake Them Ropes podcast. And also one of my cohorts on Talking Sheet Midweek at SheetSandwich.com. The one, the only, Jeff Hawkins. Jeff, how are you doing tonight?
Happy to be here, although we have to stop introducing me after both you and Bix because it feels like such a step down. After listening to all these like great credits, oh, and here's internet wacky, you know, whatever. No, I'm happy to be here, happy to talk some 80s wrestling, happy to be on a show that Jordan Breen has guested on.
Yes.
Because I'm a big fan of Jordan Breen, so I had hoped one day to sound as intelligent as him on the air, but I have failed miserably at that. But very happy to be here.
Awesome, awesome.
Is that how we should introduce you if we ever have you on again? Wacky guy, Jeff Hawkins.
Oh no, yeah,
the guy that wants to be like Jordan Breen.
I'll have another credit by then, I think, because stuff in the fire. So
yes, stuff in the ether. I guess we'll say. And, yeah, and speaking of Jordan, we're getting around that time for the Brawl for All show.
Yeah, we got to figure out when we're doing that.
Yeah, when I was doing research for the year to do this week, 98, Brawl for All was getting going. So, yeah, we're going to pick out the a perfect time to do that show. But we'll go 1988 right now instead of 1998. Let's go ahead and start this off. And
we don't have any shoots this week, do we?
Confirmed shoots or work shoots?
I don't know.
Well, one thing we do have.
We don't have Mike Plotcheck knocking people out or getting people knocked or not getting knocked out, do we?
No, but we do have a lot of Between the Sheets ongoing storylines happening.
Oh, God, yes.
This week, which is always great, and we lead off with one as we go to the World Wrestling Federation, and Bam Bam Bigelow has left the promotion.
You really should have said Bam Bam Bigelow more dramatically. We haven't had as much of him lately, though.
I know, but this was a big one. Dave Meltzer, the Wrestling Observer, has heard several different versions, but apparently have included the harder Travis schedule that the WWF is putting the wrestlers on, which Dave says is any trip of less than 600 miles, the wrestlers now have to drive to the location rather than fly on lengthy trips as they had been doing. Yikes. And the cutback in payoffs.
Actually, let's stop for a second, because this was a story on its own in Wrestling Forum that week, and mm-hmm. the budget cuts and the travel changes, and yes, this is our first episode where we'll be using stuff from Wrestling Forum newsletter.
Great listeners, for contributing so we can get in that research material.
Yes, we actually didn't get them scanned yet, so I was entering in stuff from these, but that... this was a big deal as far as the budget cuts and stuff. And I'm trying to remember, what is the policy today? Like, as far as how long a loop is. Like, I know everything's routed so that it has to be under a certain length. But for a while, this was still an official policy, wasn't it?
Yes. I don't think they do that anymore because they don't have any type of schedule like they do back then.
They don't have anything that's more than 600 miles. But is it still...
No.
But isn't the current routing... based on this concept?
Yeah, I think it's 200 or 300, I thought. I mean, it's a lower number, but they still right. have the policy. Somehow.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, they still have the policy.
So it still is an official policy if they were to have a tour that was over a bigger geographic area.
Yeah.
And I mean, this pissed off a lot of wrestlers. I mean, because also they were getting to route the frequent flyer miles themselves still at this point. And also, I mean, the flights were getting paid for, right? So this also means they're going to be paying more of their own road expenses, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and and the thing is, they were doing these wild ass scheduling of, you know, towns in this era, especially, you know, where you could be in the West Coast one night and then have to fly to the East Coast. I mean, you're going around the country in one day. You know, to make shots. I mean, it's insane schedule. So
when did they officially start doing the current routing?
I would say early to mid 90s.
Yeah. Because especially when they did that experiment where they would do, like, for example, they do all the New York market shows in one week. And at first they did all the same lineup on all three, too, which did wonders for attendance.
Oh, yeah.
I guess that's the beginning of that, right?
Yes. Yeah. You didn't see the complete insanity. And you have guys that would work, like when you had your A team, your B team, and your C team, you would have some guys that would switch back and forth. There was some guys work B team one night, then fly where the A team was at and work A team shows. I mean, it total nuts. Mainly because, you know, there would be guys that were market specific, you know, stars or had names in certain territories where they could be, you know, let's say somebody could be in LA one night, but they were a name in Florida. So they had if the other crew was in Florida, they had to immediately fly to Florida to be with that crew.
Or the Hart Foundation and the Bulldogs in Calgary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So just,
well, given that the McMahons didn't change the ring until they had to take bumps in it, I'm certain is probably when they had to make a second show in a week, possibly.
Yeah, that's a good point, because they were just going to television. So, yeah, I mean, that's a good point, Jeff. All right. No doubt he was unhappy as how he was being used, since he had really been misused almost from the start, which is partially why he didn't get over to the level the promotion expected. No real word on Bigelow's future, but it is expected he'll make a deal to work Japan, where he became a major attraction in 1987 and drew sellout crowds against Inoki. And there's even some talk he'll make a few spot dates for Continental, since there is a connection between Bigelow and Paulie Dangerously that dates back several years. Some of you may recall that the first national press Bigelow ever received, which was actually a year or two before he ever wrestled for a major promotion, was in Norm Kaiser's Wrestling News magazine with stories byline by Paul Heyman. Now, Jeff, regarding Bigelow's usage, me and Bix have talked about on this show before how probably the best run he ever had in his career was like his first full years of the guy. I mean, working in Memphis and doing the stuff in Japan. And, you know, even though he's Crusher Yurkov and World Class, he still had this aura about him. And then he goes to WWF and they gave him his, you know, look that he would have for the rest of his career with the Flames and all that stuff on his tights. But they brought in Sir Oliver Humperdinck as his manager. That didn't work. He didn't work as that type of baby face. I mean, what were your thoughts on Bigelow in this era?
I thought it was a mistake to bring him in as a baby face. he was a guy who could have been brought in immediately as a heel and done the Hogan program up top. Because, I mean, that's the kind of guys they were programming at that time. And I think Humperdinck was a letdown, especially the way they marketed it, where they were doing the who's going to be Bam Bam Bigelow's manager. They had a great marketing plan, and they had all the pictures of the managers on TV, and every week when it turned out not to be that guy, they'd end up eliminating him on the screen. So, I mean, they had built him properly. I just, you know, and I think also partially teaming him with Hogan for that Survivor Series might have also hurt him in a way from being a standout guy as opposed to being on his own and really building something there. The other thing I remember is once he left here. Now, did he do a stint in Continental before he went to Crockett for that short stint?
He may have worked the spot show,
I just remember they bring him in. They bring him into Crockett. And there's an episode of Worldwide. They're setting him up for a feud with Barry Windham for the U.S. title. And Flair just absolutely kills him. Absolutely kills him in a promo. Where he's talking about, you know, women don't like to be fat. Well, fat boy, you know, he's just everything about his look and how he's not going to have the cardio. It just really just absolutely a burial of Bigelow.
Yeah, Flair had a hard on for Bigelow for some reason. He did that on numerous occasions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to find a Bigelow schedule here.
Theory for you, which actually ties into something else I was going to mention.
Yeah.
Perhaps it was because he was a friend of, wait for it, Eddie Gilbert.
Yeah. Mm. All right. We have Bigelow in Memphis on August the 1st, naturally. Then he went to New Japan. He worked for Windy City Wrestling on August the 12th. Had the match with Terry Gordy, big. So we talked about the original Battle of the Bam Bams September the 30th. And then went to Crockett right after that. So no Continental, at least on my records.
The other thing I was going to say is this is the first of at least two times in a little over 2 years that he's supposed to come in to work for Eddie Gilbert and doesn't.
Yes.
Because he was supposed to come into Continental for the... I guess, was he supposed to come in specifically for the Road to Birmingham? Or?
Yes, he was mentioned, yeah, for that.
So that's a little more complicated than that because of Eddie leaving. But then he was supposed to be in the USWA title tournament in 1992 with Eddie booking, and he no-showed that.
Yeah. And this is, you know, the beginning of the Bam Bam Gypsy run, where he's pretty much bouncing around. And it's like this, other than New Japan, it's like this until 1992 when he goes back to WWF. And he has the long run there. He's just all over the place in this time period in America. But, yeah, Bigelow, I agree with Jeff. I think that if they brought Bigelow in as a heel, that a Hogan program would have been good. A Savage program would have been fun for the title. Oh. I mean, you got Boss Man months later, you know, to do that athletic big guy role against Hogan. I mean, Bigelow could have done it first. And they probably did good money.
The cartwheels and everything got over. That was fine. It was just, you know, Humperdinck was such a... It was such a letdown for everybody because nobody in WWF, at least those hardcore fans, didn't really know who Oliver Humperdinck was at the time.
Right.
And it really didn't do a lot for his character in the promotion.
Right. Nobody who knows who he was. He just seems like this bootleg Captain Lou Albano.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with the jacket of all the colors. You know, look like a peacock out there. And you put Bam Bam Bigelow with Jimmy Hart or something like that as a heel, a lead heel. You're making money. You're doing something. But
also, where he had worked really well as a babyface was in Memphis, which was being this unhinged guy who had been a heel.
Yeah, and when he came in to work as a babyface, he was still basically the same guy.
Right. Although, I mean, with that though, WWF back then, even more so now, not really great at booking unhinged characters.
No, so, they were still very family.
Well, it's obviously saw
worked anyway.
Yeah, well, it's obviously saw money in him because they made him part of that first Nintendo video game when they only had like six characters in it.
And him and Andre were also the only two that had unique moves individual to them. Bam Bam had the cartwheel. Andre had what the instruction manual called barge.
And Andre would have been a natural
people.
Yeah, Andre would have been the natural opponent for Bam Bam, but Andre hadn't gotten to bad physical condition that Bam Bam eventually wasn't. I mean, he wasn't the right guy to work against Andre. That's why Duggan and Andre worked as well as it did, and Jay, because they were smart enough to work around Andre's limitations. Bigelow wasn't adept at that yet, because he was still, fairly new to the business. But yeah, Bam Bam Bigelow, I tell you, what could have been? That's the story about Bigelow for sure. He had a good career, but what could have been? All right. And speaking of what could have been, in a bit of news, which isn't so much a major item to wrestling fans, but is to a large segment of the Observer readership, since Dave says it's the single most asked question of the past month to him, is what is Owen Hart going to do? The word Dave has is that Owen Hart will be starting with Titan Sports before you read this, apparently under a mask as a C-team performer, and he'll be probably debuting on television along with Terry Taylor at the TV tapings on July 13th from La Crosse, Wisconsin, and July 14th in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. In fact, if Dave's not mistaken, Hart will be appearing in the small spot shows up in California next week. There are a couple of ways of looking at this. First, it is simply impossible for Hart to have the caliber of matches with Titan that he did on his most recent Japan tour against the likes of Shiro Koshinaka, Hiroshi Hase, and Keiji Yamada. The opponents aren't good enough, and he wouldn't be allowed to do the moves. Still, if marketed correctly, and Titan generally does a good job in this regard, and certainly a better job than any other promotion, a flying wrestler with the right gimmick and the right kind of push and the right opponents can be a major thing for Titan. They don't have anyone like him. Jimmy Snuka was only 5'10" and was one of the three or four hottest babyfaces of the last decade in Northeast simply for one move. Satoru Sayama, who weighed 60 pounds less than Hart, was one of the two or three biggest names in this entire business in the early part of the decade. At the same time, Sayama never would have been as big of a star as he was if he didn't have the Dynamite Kid, Bret Hart, Black Tiger, Kuniaki Kobayashi, and others of nearly the same size and of good caliber to feud with. Still, with all the big guys in Titan, Hart is a comparative midget. Though in talent, the midgets are the big guys in most cases. And if the size difference is accentuated by putting him in with the wrong foe and have himself size to fake strength moves, it will be very easy for Titan fans to simply see him as, quote, too small, unquote. So, yeah, I mean, that's the Owen Hart deal, Jeff. You know, he was a darling of the aftermags in this era. He was getting spotlighted on Joe Pesci's Pro Wrestling This Week. So he had a name around him. Plus, you know, everybody knows he's Bret's brother. So he had this name about him. You knew about him. And you thought, okay, it's just a matter of time before he goes to WWF. But when he gets to WWF, they completely drop the ball on him.
The Blue Blazer.
What are your thoughts on the Blue Blazer gimmick, which, of course, he took on, and how they mishandled him?
I just love that Dave says, and certainly a better job than any other promotion, when within the year you'd be getting Muda in the NWA, who, you know, he wasn't great, but still, I mean, he was handled quite well, I thought, for a guy who couldn't even cut a promo. Let me ask you something. Which side of the ledger do you guys fall on in terms of the story? Because Bo James on your other podcast brought the question up in my mind in some ways. Did they have gimmicks and then they just put performers in them, or did they have the performer and put the gimmick on them for the most part? Because we have Terry Taylor here, and you had the rumored Mr. Perfect Red Rooster split, which depending on who you, which depending on what you believe, Owen Hart and the Blue Blazer, there's a possibility, because one of my friends growing up, his mom was Tom Zink's cousin, I think second cousin. He was kind of our in for tickets to WCW later on when Zink was there. There was a possibility that he might have gotten the Blue Blazer gimmick at one time, because that was the rumor when Blue Blazer first came on, was that this was this guy's relative, Tom Zink. Or do you just think that that's BS and that Owen was going to get this gimmick all along?
Well, Zink was pretty much blacklisted.
Isn't this when he's trying to negotiate with them over settling the lawsuit and maybe come back in, though?
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that. Yeah, so he was trying.
It's not incredibly far-fetched. As far as Owen, I was kind of wondering, How much do you think his outfit being so crappy hurt him in WWF during this run?
A lot.
It looked silly as hell, yes.
Do you guys know the story with that? That it was like a friend of Martha's, and like, I guess the way Brett tells it was that he didn't want to disappoint Martha or Martha's friend, so he used it when, whereas Brett had, you know, hooked him up with whoever was making the gear for everyone else to make like a really cool outfit, and we got what we got.
Well, that was part of it, but also, I mean, that didn't affect his push. I mean, they didn't push him.
They weren't ever going to push him. I mean, at least in this.
He did. I mean, I think it could have, to a point.
I don't know.
They probably didn't see him that way, no, but would they, did him looking kind of bootleg contribute to that?
Yes.
Maybe. It could have.
Because I know that when they first came on, the idea of a superhero character in WWF did appeal to quite a lot of kids.
Right.
But looking like kind of the first version of Spider-Man, you know, with the homemade mask, that probably did hurt him in some way, in addition to just not having very good promos.
Also, looking at, you know, I know this is 28 years ago, but Owen Hart being considered a relative midget when, I mean, he was an inch shorter than Brett at the most?
Mm.
Yeah, but I think you know where Dave was getting
it. No, but he was still, we're talking about a guy who was pretty much 6 feet tall. I mean, I'm just saying, you look, if he was on the, if Owen Hart was on the WWE roster right now, he'd be, what, about Seth Rollins size?
I mean, this is a different era of WWE. Yeah,
I'm just saying. It's weird looking at it compared to now, right? He'd be about the same size as Rollins and Ambrose.
But you got to look at the. I mean, like I said, you got to look at the heel side, who he's working against.
And this still early, and this is still early in Brett being a single. You know,
but he's still actually tagging with.
Yeah.
Still, I mean, he's doing the bad news.
He is a singles at this moment.
He's feeding the bad news Brown.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But you look at the heel, heel roster WWF in this time period. All right. We got Boss Man, One Man Gang, Dino Bravo, Andre, Rick Rude, the Rougeaus. Let's see who else. We got
Greg Valentine, Honky Tonk.
Greg Valentine, Volkov, Zukov, Hercules is still heel this time or no?
I think he might have just turned around this time.
No, Hercules is still babyface because Morocco is still there.
No, so I'm saying he would have just turned, though, because he was a heel at WrestleMania.
Could have been. Bad News, Honky Tonk Man, who's a tall guy. Yeah, I mean, there's a Ron Bass.
So your small guys are basically Honky Tonk Man, Rick Rude, and the Rougeaus.
Yes.
They're gigantic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there you go. I mean, that's your main heel roster. Yeah, you got Terry Taylor coming in. Yeah, you got Kurt Hennig coming in. But, and DiBiase, forgot about DiBiase. DiBiase's there too.
Who's also gigantic.
Who's also a very deceptive big man. It's just the way the roster was set up that unless they got behind him full force and pushed him, you know, it was going to be tough.
Like an El Generico type here. That would have been the only way.
Yeah, that's a good call. I mean, it was tough for Owen Hart. Now, I think only WF was really the only ones that were really talking to him at this time. I don't think the NWA at this time was – I mean, it was the next year they would for sure because we talked about it on the show. But mm-hmm. at this time, they weren't looking at it. So, wait a minute. No? They did think about him for the Crockett Cup. You know, when they were trying to work a deal with Calgary that we talked about on this show.
Right.
To try to get a team to come in for the Crocker Cup. And it's probably presumably Owen or bringing in Pillman and Bruce.
Right. Probably Owen and Ben Bass are ever be a company.
Yeah. So they were looking, but it wasn't like it was the next year when they were really, really trying to get it. So I don't know. And Owen, of course, was not the Blue Blazer to begin with. He's the Blue Angel. When he first started with that gimmick.
Looking even more kind of bootleg because he was wearing his regular gear that he wore in Calgary in Japan. And he wore what looks like Steve DeSalvo's mask from when he had that run in Calgary where he got Firebolt or whatever and wore a mask.
Yeah. All right,
it's literally Owen just asked someone for a mask, it looked like.
Yeah, let me borrow that. Speaking of Canadians, the Rick Martel injury angle was never shown on WF Superstars. Apparently because Martel left earlier than scheduled and they had to announce his injury on TV before the segment was to air, and they like you to believe the TV is up to date. So they were unable to show it after I'd already announcing the injury. Besides, the injury didn't look all that convincing. Yeah, Dave was there because it was taped in Oakland. But during this run of television. But yeah, then this is to get Martel off of television. Basically, what to get him ready to come back as the model later on. But I don't.
But he was off for like 9 months. He was probably setting up his real estate business too, I would think.
Yeah, and of course he worked some places. Like he worked for World Wrestling Council, a couple of shots. But yeah, he wasn't really working nowhere in wrestling, so it was a non-wrestling deal, whatever it was.
Yeah, I don't think the injury angle looked that bad. I thought he did a solid job taking the demolition decapitation on the floor. I thought he did a good job making that look like an injury angle level move.
Yeah, but kill Tito Santana dead. And Tito Santana suffered more than Martel did.
Yeah, that's the beginning of the end for Tito.
Yeah, I mean, it really is.
He just goes back to working with Greg Valentine when at a point where that doesn't mean anything anymore.
Yeah, and he's just languishing, you know, in the mid-card for a long time.
They still had great matches, though. Him and Valentine went right back to having great matches together.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's natural with those two.
Wait, did they bring him back in 89 as the model, or did they bring him back for the with Strikeforce? For WrestleMania 5.
They brought back a Strikeforce,
and then he turns there, and then he becomes
right.
a model. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. They did the turn after that. But you could tell he had an attitude.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that something was going on. So, all right. June 29th, WWF had a house show in Montreal and the Forum in front of 11,000 plus. And here's the card we have here. Big Boss Man beats Lanny Poffo in 8:17. One Man Gang beats Bam Bam Bigelow by forfeit. Of course, Bigelow's no showing. When Bigelow failed to appear due to a family emergency.
This is the week we should be talking about wrestlers no-showing due to family emergencies. Yeah.
Yeah. Richard Chalon was said to have been Bigelow's substitute, but the Quebec Athletic Commission would not allow him to compete because he didn't have a license to wrestle.
Really?
Think about that. This guy was a Montreal mainstay for years, and somehow his license had lapsed. How does that happen? Because Charlon replaced Bigelow everywhere else on this tour, except this show.
Might be a Montreal thing, or Quebec, you know.
Yeah, I'm just saying. Yeah,
they've always been a little different in Quebec.
Yeah. I mean, he was able to work everywhere else but Quebec. So interesting. Frenchie Martin beat Sam Houston, of course, because they're in Montreal. Dino Bravo of Ultimate Warrior in 8:23 using the ropes. Warrior assaulted Frenchie Martin after the match.
Did he ever beat Warrior anywhere else?
No.
Did Frenchie Martin beat anybody anywhere else? Jeez.
No, I think I've seen him get wins on primetime.
He got wins. He got some wins.
Well, you also have to remember, he was a vital part of the French and Spanish language TV at the time.
Yeah.
And he beat Sam Houston everywhere on this little run here. And all these markets they were at in that area.
But yeah, people,
poor Sam.
A lot of people don't know that. That for years he was the main. His segment, what was it? Frenchie Studio.
Yeah.
Replaced Piper's Pit and all that on the syndicated shows that were in French and Spanish.
Yes. Yeah. Andre the Giant, Rick Rude, Jake Roberts, and Jim Duggan. 16:24 when Rude pinned Roberts. And your main event, Jacques and Raymond Rougeau, who of course had been babyface this year. Beat the WF World Tag Champions Demolition by DQ in 1940. Now, Calgary on July 1st drew 12,000 fans, 160,000 Canadian.
Stampede week, right?
Yep, as Jim Brunzell pinned Steve Lombardi after a drop kick in 10 minutes. Negative 1/2 star. Greg Valentine beat Coco Ware by DQ in 13 minutes when Don Morocco interfered. 1/2 star. Bad news, drew Bret Hart. Think about that. It's over 20 minutes. Best match on the card. Brett worked much harder than usual in front of his hometown fans. 3.5 stars. They couldn't have Brett go over Bad News in Calgary and Stampede Week. Really? Really? I know Bad News is a big name too there, but really? Come on. Honky Tonk Man over Brutus Beefcake after hitting him with a foreign object in 16 minutes and a dud. British Bulldogs beat the Islanders, which this Islanders team was Haku and High Chief Offie in 16 minutes. Dynamite pinned Offie. Dynamite was hurting bad during the match. Haku was the only one of the four who performed at any level, which disappointed the local fans who watched the Bulldogs practically grow up and have so many great matches before they became famous. 2 stars. Don Morocco went to a double countout with Jim Neidhart, where Neidhart played the heel in 9 minutes. 1 star. Ron Bass pinned the Junk Food Dog. That's right. It's a 1988 Observer in 8 minutes. 1.5 stars. And Macho Man over Ted DiBiase in your world title match in 20 minutes. 3 stars. Now, Big, she got to describe there, buddy, the High Chief Offie gimmick.
It was Stevie Offie with the High Chief tattoos, a la The Rock or Peter Maivia. And he was the third Islander. And I know John McAdam always used to say in his tape list that he was promised a huge push if he got all the tattoos, right?
Yeah.
Although I don't remember ever hearing that anywhere else. Not that I don't trust John. And yeah, that's about it. And he replaces Tonga. Well, first it was the three of them, but in reality, he replaced Tonga Kid.
Yeah, because he had dipped out. But again, Jeff. Mm-hmm. You can't give Brett a clean win in Calgary, you know, really?
I think they were also giving Bad News Brown just his props in Calgary too, and they thought, you know, we won't have one beat the other, and then they'll be mad enough to buy for the rematch.
That was the finish around the horn, though, was Time Limit Drop.
Yeah,
and then you know you look at the next show, neither one of them's on the next Calgary show.
Also,
so there you go.
I mean, we've noticed this in watching a lot of WWF house shows over the years, but you notice it here. They really did not do a good job managing which matches got more time.
No, they did.
Now, is it possible they were? I mean, yeah, it's Brett's hometown, but this is still relatively soon into his face push run, and he's not exactly full on face just. I mean, he's kind of a
right,
reluctant
he's a baby
face
by default in this program.
Yeah, he's a reluctant face in this program. Maybe they were kind of covering their bases here to make sure that, you know what, if he is getting booed here in Calgary still, that we don't, you know, we don't put him over. We don't put the actual bad guy over. It's, you know, it's kind of like how they do with guys they're not sure about now, for the most part.
Yeah, that's a good point. And also, I mean, Neidhart played heel. It's mm-hmm. said that against Morocco.
That was how he went everywhere he went after during this weird split. Like, if you watch the first that WrestleFest show in Milwaukee, he's working as a heel.
Yeah, it's weird. All right, speaking of weird, numerous cities that the Powers of Pain have worked in since their debut have had lots of fans think that they were the Road Warriors.
Which in is fact, the point.
In fact, one this week, I think it was Warwick, Rhode Island, on July 3rd, in front of 620 fans. When they the main event was them against the Bolsheviks, the fans thought they were the Road Warriors.
Was that the Tent Tour in Warwick? One of the Tent Tour shows, or is that a different?
It does have a venue, but listen to this card. This is why it drew 620 fans. Brian Blair over Iron Mike Sharp. The Conquistadors over the Young Stallions. George the Animal Steel over Dangerous Danny Davis by countout. Hercules beats Ken Patera, and the Powers of Pain over the Bolsheviks.
Okay, I'm going to assume that's a Tent Tour show. yeah, it's one of those things that never gets talked about unless you read through these old observers, is that WWF fans who didn't really know who the Road Warriors were other than from seeing them on the cover of magazines assumed that these guys who hadn't been on TV yet, who had the Road Warrior type haircuts and the face paint and the upbeat rock music type entrance were just the Road Warriors with their new WWF names.
And they're killing them on Crockett. They're killing them on the Crockett.
Because
they were supposed to be doing scaffold matches. And so they said, oh, you two were too coward and had to leave the town.
Yeah, Paul Jones saying they had no guts.
Right. Ellering went off on them. I think Dusty, also said something.
Oh, yeah, they buried him hard on television.
Which was kind of, the whole thing of asking them to do it in the first place was bullshit. Because, like, they're not... to do that, they were going to do it, like, for every night of the tour, guys their size doing scaffold match bumps? Really?
Especially those scaffolds, which were taller than the usual ones they were using in other promotions.
Yeah, and then, of course, who replaces him in those matches? Ivan Koloff and the Angel of Death as a Russian. So there you go.
Ivan Koloff.
Yeah.
Or Angel of Death, who's bigger.
Yeah. Oof. But why? Well, I mean, Powers of Pain. They had, I mean, in all fairness, they had a good run in WWF.
Yeah.
You know, they really did. You gotta give them that. I mean, they made the right decision for them.
The double turn was a bit weird at the time, but it was probably the right decision to make.
Yeah, it was the right decision to make. But it turned them into having jobs. Well, the Barbarian and Warlord were both there till 92.
Yeah, they should probably not split them. They probably should not split them up. But
we wouldn't have those great singles gimmicks though, with the Barbarian with his antlers and the Warlord with his cyborg type gear. Yeah, I mean, we wouldn't have had that.
Or if you're going to split them up, Barbarian should have been the one to get the push.
Yeah.
Oh, I know, right? Yeah, for sure. All right, Wrestling Forum. Here we go, John Gallagher. Reporting the Wrestling Forum that Sean Mooney is replacing not just Craig DeGeorge, but also Gene Okerlund, who, depending on who you believe, was fired or quit. His Titan source gave no reasoning for firing other than the standard differences of philosophy line. Gene is apparently fishing at home in Minnesota and preparing for an audition to host a game show. In the following issue, Gallagher added that Okerlund was in talks for a tell-all book deal and book tour, even though he had little bad to say about Titan. Well, of course, Okerlund didn't go anywhere, but Mooney definitely did replace Craig DeGeorge, who I've been seeing on my television this weekend because the team he works for in Major League Baseball, the Miami Marlins, are playing my Atlanta Braves. And he's working there under his real name, Craig Minervini.
Minervini,
excuse me. And he looks the same, just with almost 30 years added to him. But, Sean Mooney, Jeff, guy became pretty much a WWF, I would say cult hero or something like that, because he was on all the Coliseum videos when they really started becoming, the thing in the late 80s, early 90s, when they started, having different stuff. And he had charisma. He was good for what he did. What are your thoughts about Sean?
He was perfectly fine as the guy that seemed like he had news journalism integrity when he's sitting at that desk and reporting news, as opposed to just say like an out of work actor, like sorry about the dogs in the background. who's Joe
Fowler?
Yes,
the Joe Fowler. Guy, yes.
Yeah, and I remember him from he hosted a game show that was like American Gladiators but set in the Wild West.
Oh, what was that? Are you sure he hosted that one? I thought, or are you thinking Knights and Warriors?
No, he hosted the one in the Wild West.
Even happened. I thought that was one that didn't even get on the air.
No, I saw it on the air in Virginia before I left. I know it was on there very short lived, and they were using like paintball guns, I think, for the final thing with the shootout. But no, he came off like a game show host on WWF television as well. Sean Mooney always came off as a guy who, and of course, he'd later go work for, I believe, WWOR.
Yes.
In New York. I mean, he always came off as a guy who they plucked from a news desk to sit at a news desk. So I had no problem with Sean, and he always seemed to hype it to the point where he wasn't getting in the way. Like, say, Okerlund would always ham it up to some point, but he was also
– Well, that's Okerlund.
But he was also – he also had a job as an interviewer to do that. Mooney played it far more straight as opposed to having his own take on it.
You know what Sean Mooney
– Yes, that
you
would
know
be
– You know what Sean Mooney
never
did?
Saw this.
You know what Sean Mooney did for WWF?
What?
He was doing voiceover work because there was a commercial on one of the shows I watched where Sean Mooney was doing the voiceover.
Sean Mooney, and this is for me as a kid, used to watching ESPN religiously, Sean Mooney used to work for Major League Baseball Productions. And he would do some, you know, I would say wraparounds for like some of – they used to have this show called Baseball's Greatest Hits. And Sean would do wraparounds for them. And if you watch the credits, you see Sean Mooney as one of the producers. So, yeah, he worked for Major League Baseball Productions back in the early 80s.
So as far as Okerlund, was he gone at least for like a month? Like, what happened?
I don't think so. I don't ever remember him being gone. Let me see here. All right. We go to 1988 television.
Remember, Wrestling Forum's bi-weekly, so this is over the course of several weeks.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Okerlund, he's on location. He's in location in September doing the Akeem deal. He doesn't do anything much on camera. He's mainly – Okerlund, this era, is mainly at the control center updates.
So he wasn't doing – he wasn't going to arenas and doing the podium interview, so that was
– No, not until later in the year.
Okay.
Yeah, really until DeGeorge left. So
okay, maybe it's possible something could have happened and he had taped a lot of stuff in advance.
Possible. It's possible.
It says that he's – I'm looking up now. It says that people are asking what was the reason behind his brief firing in June 1988.
Where are you seeing – looking at this?
Where it's – this is Kayfabe Memories.
Okay.
Oh, I totally forgot he did an interview with them.
No. This is on their board. And it says it is rumored that Gene Okerlund has been fired and will be replaced by Sean Mooney from there. And they got that, I think, from the Observer.
Okay.
Not this week's, but maybe next week's.
Well, maybe. Who knows?
Oh, Finkel's the one who brought it up. Finkel said he had been fired in 1988 for a short time.
I'm sure it was probably alcohol related. Knowing Gene. Or they're trying to send a message to him.
Also, Wild West Showdown. I'm just looking at the IMDb. The characters included Dog Breath. Alibi,
huh?
Three Fingers, Badger, Chance, Silk, George.
Just George?
Bull, Snakebite, and Kid. Or Kid. K-I-D space K-I-D-D.
Okay, I got an update here.
Okay.
Because they're both from The Observer, June 20th, 1988. It is rumored that Gene Okerlund has been fired and will be replaced by Sean Mooney. August 8th, 1988, Gene Okerlund is back. He and Vince apparently have huge blow-ups about twice a year. This year, Gene quit after the Slammies and came back the next day. His contract is too lucrative to stay away too long, but Vince wants to tone down his role to just doing pay-per-view updates in NBC. No more on-the-road interviews and no more hosting All-American Wrestling.
There you go.
This is me. They say I assume he is talking. They said on this one, I assume he is talking about Gene quitting after the '87 Slammies. So I guess that's just a flashback because there were no Slammies in '88.
No. Well, speaking of Vince and blowups, the latest in the Bruno Sammartino and Vince McMahon feud is that Titan is now, from this day forward, going to call superstar Billy Graham, quote, the living legend, unquote.
Yeah.
McMahon pettiness in full effect here. And this version of the Bruno Vince feud was the most vicious one, Vix. I mean, this is when you got all the good stuff in this part.
Yeah, from between this part and the scandals, I guess.
Yeah. Also in this era, this was during the time when Bruno and Captain Lou Albano had hooked up with their little hotline, which I've been seeing commercials for watching 88 NWA television.
Oh, the trivia hotline with Coach?
Yeah, which is always a hoot. Yeah. Bruno.
How long did Graham last in 88 in the WWF?
When was he gone?
Graham, he did SummerSlam as an announcer.
Yeah.
He wasn't working anywhere. because he couldn't work no more. Let me see if I can find a specific day. But he got, I mean, I love Superstar Billy Graham, but oh wait a minute, here he is. He's working. He's doing Los Angeles shows on Z Channel with Rod Trungard in December of '88.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So I didn't realize it was that long. What a pairing that is.
All right, here he is. Oh, here you go, Biggs. Boston Gar on January 13th, 1989. Rod Trungard, Superstar Billy Graham, and Lord Alfred Hayes on commentary.
Marv.
Rod Trungard and Superstar Billy Graham in Los Angeles on January 29th. And that's his last one.
Okay, so he was there over a year after this.
Yeah, January 29th.
In, or almost a year.
Mm. Yep. The living legend, Superstar Billy Graham. And now let's go to Japan, All Japan Pro Wrestling. And
he didn't say the magic words.
The land of the rising sun.
Yay.
Yeah. Every time I say that, y'all start playing the Great Muda's theme music or something like that.
Nice. Just,
which one?
The WCW original one. You know, the 1989 version. But the new series started on July the 2nd before a sellout crowd of 2,200 at Korakuen Hall, which is actually a realistic number, as Jumbo Shiruda and Yoshiaki Yatsu.
Wait, I thought they didn't really hold 2,200 back then.
It could. You could. 2,150 is like your standard Supernova Agency full house. But 50 extra people, you could probably squeeze them in somewhere.
So when All Japan Women was packing them in, like in the mid-80s, what was the real number?
Around that. I mean, it wasn't 4,000 people like you were seeing.
But anyone running less than the All Japan Women configuration who was claiming 2,150 or 2,200 was lying.
Yeah.
Okay.
More often than not. But anyway, their new tour started on July 2nd, and the main event was the Olympics. Jumbo Shiruda and Yoshiaki Yatsu over Terry Bam Bam Gordy and Leo Burke in 9 minutes when Yatsu pinned Burke. We had Stan Hansen over Shunji Takano with the Lariat, 354. Tenyu Genichiro and Ashirahara down Tiger Mask 2 and Akira Taue, when Tenryu put Taue to sleep in 1223. Great Kabuki and Hiroshi Wajima over Jammin' Mitch Snow, who just got a minute, and Sheik Ali, who was Steve Pettipas from the Maritimes there.
I don't know why Dave called it Pettipas.
I know. Pettipas. Giant Baba and Takashi Ishikawa over Rosh Kimura and Goro Shirumi. And the Footloose.
No, not the Footloose. The Footloose.
The Footloose.
The Footloose. Down Kenta Kobashi, who Dave is told is Japan's best candidate for Rookie of the Year, after trying to come up with a good North American candidate, which is virtually impossible so far this year. The best he could find was Steve Blackman in Canada, who isn't good, but is at least decent. And Shinichi Nakano. And then there's this match. Davis Sammartino and the Destroyer, that's right, Dick Byer, beat Big John Tenta and Asao Takagi when Destroyer used his legendary figure four leg lock on Takagi. By the way, Destroyer is 57 years old. And there were some other matches. But, wow, there's a lot here. But, Jeff, first, you got to tell your Mitch Snow story, because this is something else.
Mitch Snow, his father was my PE teacher in this year, 1988. a well-renowned baseball coach, but just old, mean as a snake, could barely walk, smoked like a chimney, and always wore this London fog jacket and khakis, and more growled than actually said words. Like he'd call Roll and just meh. And what did he say? I think he said Hawkins. Just a character in that way. And I remember we're changing in the locker room, and Snow comes in to visit his father and gives him this big old chop, which of course Dad no sells at all. And he just looks and just calls us all a bunch of pussies. And leaves, which I'm just like, this is the first time I ever, okay, great. But, oh, he's a pro wrestler. Yeah, I'd known him kind of tangent. I had heard of him because he was in the papers, but it's like, hey, what's up, pussies? Go out there and run. So you're just like, what? And then like two years later, he's volunteer baseball coaching at my school, and three of my classmates end up getting into a fight with him after back-talking with him. To the point where he's arrested on assault charges. But his whole thing was, during this fight, he didn't throw a punch on purpose. His entire defense was, I didn't throw a punch at them precisely for the reason that I'd get an assault charge. So he was doing like open hand slaps and headlocks. And I think someone actually accused him of trying to do a suplex on someone. So he's just taking on all three guys and trying to get control of them. But no, it was a fight. And he got in a lot of trouble over this because he was just a volunteer coach at the time. The charges were eventually continued, and then because he didn't get any trouble later on, they were dismissed. But a tragic story in that his dad died in 2000, Coach Snow did. And on the day that the big article about Jim Snow and his funeral service came out in the local paper, that's the day Mitch Snow killed himself.
Wow.
On August, I think it's August 3rd, 2000, because I checked the dates. I was like, wow, that's the same day. But I guess, you know, he and his dad were very, very tight. But still, it was just one of those things where it's like, yeah, I was just throwing open-handed slaps so that I wasn't actually punching him. So it's not really a felony assault. It's just
Wow, that's
such a bummer. Day. See, here I was all ready to make this joke about Kenta Kobashi's losing streak ending when he beat Mitch Snow, and what Mitch Snow said after that Japan tour when he was substitute gym teaching. And
He was substitute gym teaching in my school, I think, as a matter of fact, in Newport News.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So then
he
would have been doing that when Kenta Kobashi beat him.
Amazing. You should have, if you had only known in that era, you could have heckled him about Kenta Kobashi.
Oh, well, I couldn't get Japanese wrestling at that time.
You were the one guy who couldn't beat Kenta Kobashi.
I think my introduction to actual Japanese wrestling was when Tenryu eventually came over to team with the Road Warriors, and then I finally caught up on all that. But Snow had been a prelim guy, I think, in Crockett for a short time.
And AWA. Yeah.
AWA. Yeah. Jamming Mitch Snow.
Oh, yeah. One of Rob Naylor's personal favorites, Mitch Snow.
Have I ever talked about my own pro wrestling substitute gym teacher story on this show?
I don't think you have.
I know I've told you the story privately, right?
Yes.
PWI Family Magazine's writer and photographer Roy London was my substitute gym teacher on a few occasions. And he let me read his Observer and stuff and tell me stories about being at Mick Foley's wedding and taking the wedding photos for Mick Foley and all that. So that happened.
See,
that's not as good as the Snows getting into.
No. Right. Look, yours probably ended happier than mine. So,
well, my gym teacher story is tame, I guess. You know, when I was in school, we only took gym once in high school. And it was always in ninth grade. So after ninth grade, you didn't have to worry about taking gym no more if you took it.
Did you have to take like an alternative like weight training or anything, or was that just the?
I mean, that's it was an elective. You only had to take one physical education class, as far as 1 year of it, because you had to take PE and you had to take health. You took PE the first semester and health second semester, or vice versa. So anyway, my gym teacher was one of the football coaches. He was a defensive line coach, and he had sex with one of my classmates, ninth grader, 14 years old. He's married to the child care teacher, just got married. Jeez. She was pregnant. She was pregnant. This is 1993-1994 school year, and it swept under the rug. The girl leaves school. The gym teacher and his wife both leave and move to Michigan, and that was it. Stuff like that now, I mean, it may happen, but that stuff's found out. But back then, everybody knew it, and it was just all swept under the rug.
If only Bruce Hart could have handled his matters as smoothly.
I know, man.
We had to take 2 years, but we took PE and then health. And Snow's old man Snow was the type of jerk who would give you a B or who would give the nerdy kids B's or C's to ruin their GPA. Because they weren't real jocks. I got no.
Oh, so he did double his health teacher then.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, wait, probably.
So. Here you got letter grades in gym.
Yeah, we got letter grades in gym.
Yeah, I got letter grades in gym.
I did not. In my school system, we never got letter grades.
Wow, it counts as a regular class.
Oh, you millennials.
Okay.
I don't know.
You are a millennial, Bix. You know,
that's what a millennial
technically you are.
Oh, because I finished high school?
No, because you No, when you were born. I think millennials count as 1980 and after. To a certain point.
Oh, hell, I'm looking this up.
Yeah, look it up as I read about Jumbo and Yahtzee. Jumbo and Yahtzee are being billed as the undisputed world tag team champions.
A person
champion.
Reaching young adulthood around the year 2000. God damn it.
Yep, you're a millennial. Jumbo and Yahtzee are being billed as undisputed world tag champions after their DQ win over the Road Warriors on June the 10th. Dave says, don't you get sick of hearing the word undisputed when undisputed is a total contradiction of terms with the reality of the situation? There's a lot of
our hated Meltzer.
Hey, Jeff, what? There was a lot of this undisputed talk on NWA television this era, too. Undisputed NWA World Heavyweight Champion. Undisputed NWA World Tag Champions. Undisputed United States Heavyweight Champion. It was that word was being thrown on a lot in this era on that television.
Well, this was the start of the real war between Crockett and Vince. So yeah, so they're claiming themselves as the real wrestling company, and this is where this happens. If you want to be a movie star, or you want to do commercials or whatever, you go up north and whatnot. And so yeah, so that's not surprising to me. I just Dave's ability to editorialize, just as an aside, always gets me.
Yeah. All right, Shinichi Nakano, Shunji Takano, Tiger Mask 2, and Akira Taue, and Asao Takagi are forming their own group in All Japan to feud with Tenryu's Revolution Group, which I don't think ever really came to pass. Because I don't remember them having a set group. Do you, Bix? Do you remember that at all? I don't remember.
No, I'm trying to think.
I don't think they ever had. There definitely wasn't a name. And if it was a group, it did not last long, put it that way.
Well, what do we know what the group was named?
No. It didn't say. And they have any
Revolution?
And as far as I know, they didn't really feud with Revolution.
What was the name of the group? Back in the USSR? Dear Prudence? Glass Onion?
Oblada? Yeah.
Wild Honey Pie?
Julia.
Continuing story of Bungalow Bill?
Julia. Anyway.
Was this Revolution. The Olympics?
That's Yatsu and Jumbo.
Piggies would have been an interesting stable name for those guys. Piggies.
Yeah, with that group. Revolution was awesome. So nobody could face
Alter Skelter would have been interesting.
Yeah. All the Japanese magazines have been publishing photos of Tiger Mask, Mitsuharu Misawa, without his mask, giving his background, etc., since his identity has become public knowledge because of his recent wedding. Yeah, and this is pretty much when his push started to fade a little bit, too.
No one realized who Tiger Mask 2 was until Mitsuharu Misawa got married?
I think some did, but it wasn't like mainstream news. Of course, it was 2 years later when, of course, he took the mask off, but yeah.
Whatever.
All right, New Japan Pro Wrestling. There's been a lot of criticism directed at Tetsumi Fujinami of late. He's basically been put over so big because he's continually threatening to leave. In fact, he hasn't renewed his contract with New Japan, so he's technically a free agent. However, Baba and Inoki have a deal so that neither will raid the other's talent, so Fujinami can't jump to All Japan even if he want to. And I can't see him going to the UWF, even though his first match against Maeda would draw an incredible gate. But he has to do the job, and that would be the end of him. Anyway, most observers out here think it was too soon for Vader to do a clean pinfall job to Fujinami, and I agree that unless Vader is going to win the title on July 22nd, he shouldn't have done that job since Vader is being pushed as their answer to Bruiser Brody's Stan Hansen. Also, if anything is to be salvaged or Choshu's form of popularity, having him also do a job for Fujinami clean destroyed chances of that. Choshu needed a big win after Inoki and Maeda had destroyed him, but I guess he's relegated to being a semifinal tag team wrestler from this point on. Wow. Bix, although we know what's coming with Fujinami on August 8th, 1988. But what are your thoughts about what Dave said there about how Fujinami is being portrayed?
I don't know. I like the use of the word observers, unironically. probably too, because Vader debuted, what, in December?
87?
It was December, right?
Yes.
I think that's a little too soon, yeah.
But do you think he's being... The reason why he's being put over is because he's threatening to leave?
I have no idea. Was he? I mean...
Well, that's what
why is his contract up in June, too? Wasn't the January thing already going on before this?
It was different in that era for some reason. There was different things going on.
Okay.
Guys could leave at different times. Jeez. That's why Choshu left when he did, you know? There were ways around. It's not like it would become.
And then they decided, oh, everything seems copacetic between all the different promotions. Let's just have everyone's contract come up at the same time every year. That'll never bite us in the ass.
And how about this deal, you know, Jeff, where Bob and Inoki, where they won't raid the other's talent after what happened, you know, the year earlier?
Oh, gentlemen's agreements in wrestling, they're not worth it. Well, although in Japan, that culture, it's very important. So, I mean, because I deal in legal. So, I mean, oral contracts are oral contracts there. I'm actually interested that they're concerned about how Vader is going to be perceived this early into his career. I think Vader ended up okay in terms of his toughness. Yeah.
Well, my thing's Choshu. You know, anything salvaged of Choshu's former popularity. Choshu was a made man. You know, and then of course we would see what would happen the next year when he got the book, by the way. I guess, you know, since he went Booker, that, you know, it was maybe a different outlook, but yeah, I mean,
tends to be a nice cure to rebuild yourself when you get the book.
And the thing with Fujinami is at this time period, if he leaves New Japan, he's not going to All Japan because of that deal. Now, right. Immediately. UWF, again, it's like Dave said, it was just not the right fit. So he has nowhere to go other than basically America or Mexico. And we do know that Fujinami did do his American tour late in 88. So who knows?
Also, that no rating each other thing lasted for a while because I remember from Dynamite Kid's book, him talking about how when he wanted Johnny Storm to come in to All Japan, Tokyo Joe told them, like, no, Bob and Inoki agreed they're not going to have wrestlers go back and forth anymore because the public doesn't like it because of the whole Japanese sticking with one company thing. You know, not just in wrestling, in life. And I guess he convinced him to do it, but that was the end of it.
Is it possible that Choshu could have come to America to have worked? How soon after
Choshu
this?
Or Fujinami?
Fujinami.
Fujinami did come to America in December.
Okay.
Did his tour. With Memphis and Dallas and Portland and working with the Monster Factory. I mean, he did that tour and, I mean, it could happen. Been interesting.
Mm.
All right, speaking of UWF into another Between the Sheets ongoing storyline, in the June 30th issue of Gong Magazine, Dr. Death Steve Williams sent in a letter basically challenging Akira Maeda. Actually, even though Dave doesn't know of any future tours for Williams in Japan, he is still affiliated with New Japan, and the chances of him taking on Maeda are microscopic at best. The letter read, in quoting, "Dear all my Japanese fans."
Is there a doctor in the house?
I am looking forward to go to Japan again. However, I have a very important thing to do right now. And that is to prove myself against the best world champion nowadays, Ric Flair. I think he is good enough to spend my time on. Also, I promise to all of you that I'll go to Japan as soon as possible. I want to wrestle Choshu, Fujinami, and Inoki again. However, I heard that Maeda has left New Japan. I wonder why he never came after me like he did to Choshu. I think it's because he's a smart man. I enjoy teasing him in the ring all the time. Please tell Maeda about it. I am ready anytime. And I think most smart fans know that I am tougher. But let me show all of that. Let me show all of the people. Unquote. Ironically, the UWF fans who go crazy for Maeda are the same type of fans who know about Williams' legit reputation and a UWF match between the two would be a tremendous draw. Not that it's ever going to happen.
This is better than any promo Doc cut in the NWA.
Oh, Doc promos in this era were quite a sight to be seen. But Jeff, I mean, if Doc goes to UWF and has a match with Maeda, that is a huge money match at this time period.
Oh yeah, and it would increase his. I mean, look, he's stuck in a mid card feud in Crockett right now, basically fighting Varsity Club Mike Rotunda before they turn him heel. He's never even going to get a whiff of flair. Probably would have been better business for him.
Did he? Yeah.
Oh, had he? Okay.
He had it in May.
Oh, that's right. Because they had built that up at Clash One.
Yeah,
okay.
And they had a match at the Omni. It's a world title match. So, yeah, I mean, they did that in May, and then Doc transitioned to becoming like Sting and Nikita's partner, and they would switch off in tag matches and then doing stuff.
Yeah. And he's going to be in the Tower of Doom match in that
Tower
whole
Tower of Doom, that's right.
War Games thing. On the Bash Tour.
Yeah, he was, yeah. You know, he was interchangeable.
Now, did they ever do they didn't do a Williams Flair TV program of any kind to build up that on. It was just a one-off house show match.
Well, all they did was like promos. That's
right.
No angles. Okay.
Right.
Did the UWF title come up?
It never came up. Of course it never came up.
Right.
But yeah, Doc and Maeda would have been, I don't ever remember them ever wrestling each other in New Japan as far as a singles match. Do you, Bix? I don't remember that happened.
I don't think so.
I mean, that's a big time match, but of course Doc is still fresh from having his issues in Japan at this time period. Yeah.
Wait, he had issues in Japan back then too?
Well, this was when he got caught with a pharmacy.
It happened then too?
Well, he had the, remember we talked about it on the Death of Crockett show when he had all the drugs at the airport?
I forgot about that. That's right. That's why when I made the joke.
Yeah.
About his luggage drawing more money than Sting.
Yes. Yes. But yeah, Doc.
Are you sure? I was just joking. About, is that how that came up? I thought I just joked about Doc. I guess he did have
Yeah, it came up on the show like that. Yeah. But again, I'm Doc and UWF.
Why did he think he was able to get away with it?
He's Dr. Dusty Williams.
Don't you know who I am?
Brother.
Everyone knows that if you're going to be a pro wrestler smuggling drugs into Japan, you should work as a pharmacist in your daily life. That's all I'll say about that.
Yes. But again, Doc and UWF would have been interested. All right, let's go to Mexico. If we keep the international theme going here. A couple of title deals here. Angel Azteca and Atlantis retained their Mexican national tag titles against Hombre Bala and Pirata Morgan at the 35th anniversary show at Arena Puebla on July the 2nd. And Bix, that sounds like a hell of a match.
Yes.
And Solar Dos beat Americo Raca in Cuernavaca at Arena Isabel on June 30th to win the Mexican national welterweight title.
That sounds like it would be a hell of a match if it was the other Solar.
Well, Americo Raca, you know, it's great.
That's what I'm saying, yes.
Yeah, Solar Dos, not so much as Solar One. But, yeah, not that much in Mexico this week. So there you go there. All right, now let's go to Stampede Wrestling. And a good buddy of mine who I had dealings with over the years, Trent Walters, reported in the Wrestling Forum that Angel of Death was set to come in, but decided to go to Jim Crockett Promotions instead. And Yumi Ogura and Mika Komatsu are coming in on July 15th, and the Midgets are doing as well. The Angel of Death is going to Crockett because the Powers of Pain have left. And he's coming in as the Russian Assassin to team with Ivan Koloff and be managed by Paul Jones, who Paul Jones would go on to send the promos that no one man is a Power of Pain but him. He is the Powers of Pain. Jeff, which I know you've been watching the Crockett TV lately for this show, but Angel Death is Russian Assassin. He had that gimmick for God, he went to 89 with it, so he lasted a while with it.
Had it, and then when they brought in Jack Victory as the second Russian Assassin.
That's right.
To team up with the two of them. And of course, they're billing him as 6'7". I don't think he was an inch over 6'4", 6'5". But
350 pounds. He's bigger than any pro warrior.
Yeah,
which I'm sure they love that.
Yeah, and he was that guy, you know, he was kind of a, you know, in Akbar's stable in World Class. You know, he was a guy who, you know, he was big, but he was never, you know, a star of any kind. So, I mean, he was perfect for this kind of role.
And he was, you know, he had to work as a free bird too. But yeah, I mean, he had I think the master may have hindered because he had a interesting look, Bix. So
he looked
had,
like a scary heel.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He did. He had that. His eyes were great for his character.
You know who he looked like? He looked like Tejo Khan, though. At the same time,
kind of.
Yeah, but Tejo Khan looked like Dr. Mindbender from G.I. Joe.
True.
More than anything else. Angel Devers had this psychotic look on his face. TJ Khan looked like he was playing the role. Angel Devers looked like he was the role. And of course, you know, people that don't know what Dave Sheldon's background was, the Angel Devers fix, tell everybody what Dave Sheldon was before he became a wrestler.
A bugle player?
No. Well, he probably played the bugle, but who was he aligned with, though?
In real life, I don't know about this. Before he was even
he was a power team USA.
Oh, I thought I thought you were going somewhere else with that. Yeah,
no, he's Rick Bassett. He was a
bugle player.
No, he was with.
I wasn't sure because I know I remember him playing the bugle in Global where he would play.
Yeah, Cash. But he was with Sting and Ultimate Warrior.
Yes, and Garland Donahoe, Mark Miller.
He'd
last a while in Crockett because he was one of the Black Scorpions too.
Yeah, he would get shots
well,
here.
He went back to Dallas and Calgary and other places before.
Yeah, but they would call him up though. But yeah, he went. I mean, that's where he got a start. Was in Stampede, and then 85-86. So there was a familiarity there, but
yeah, and he went back the following year, including that angle that's on YouTube where he dresses up as Batman when the movie comes out to wrestle Owen Hart.
Yes, yes.
They shaved him for this one, too.
Yeah. Now, Keith Hart continues to book along with Stu's helpful hand, but don't expect any juice for the next 3 months. That's an Ed Whalen thing, isn't it? Biggs?
Wouldn't shock me if that was a Keith thing either, though. I mean, I'm sure it was an Ed Whalen thing, but it wouldn't shock me if Keith had to do with it, too. And, like, because Keith's whole thing was that he was, like, the most realistic and most serious of the hearts.
Even more than Brett.
I guess so.
Think about that, folks. And Chris Benoit is profiled in the Wrestling Forum Stampede edition as...
The Stampede edition of their Wrestlers Are People, Too.
Wrestlers Are People, Too, quote-unquote. Here's what Trent Walters wrote about Chris Benoit. He says he's the hardest worker on the circuit and arguably the best. Quite soft-spoken, but always willing to talk. Having a good match means a lot to him, and his ring work shows it, unquote. Right, Benoit was a hell of a performer.
Yeah.
Just what we know and what happened afterwards.
Sure.
Was what it was. Well, on that note, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to go back to the United States and we're heading to the South and to the incestuous relationship of Continental Wrestling Federation, USA Wrestling, and Memphis and World Class. We'll be back after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation, placetobenation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and placetobenation.com. You can check out Scott Criscullo and me on the Mothership, The Place to Be Podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Main Event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. And relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series, led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We got sports covered too with the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy and Cowboy Sr., The Kings of Sport, led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast and the TJ McClune Show. PTBN tackles pop culture and irreverence with Richard and the Mailman, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, and if you like a hybrid of all of this in list form, check out Jordan Duncan's Rank and File. All of these shows are available on PlaySubmitation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaySubmitation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network. That's the PWO PTBN Podcast Network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the Reaction Shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
And we're back. And this is always the time of the show where we talk about our Amazon.com referral link, which is tinyurl.com/BTSAmazon, where you go and do your purchases from Amazon.com. You can use that link, go to the cart, put in your cart, check out, and we get a percentage of what you spend. Nothing more comes out of your whatever you spend. So help us out that way. And, of course, wrestling forums, stuff that we've mentioned already on the show and coming up the rest of the show, part of that was from that money. So, it's helped us out in big ways. So tinyurl.com/BTSAmazon. And, Vix, you have the purchases ready?
I forgot. Give me a moment while I bring that up.
As I do that, we'll talk about the year-end show, the best of.
Sent any suggestions for this? Because I have not actually seen anything yet.
No, get on the ball, guys. I mean, if you want to have a best of show, send us suggestions, and we'll try to get one out there. What you want to hear, the best segments of the past 49 shows, now 50 shows. So, do that, and let's see what we can come up with. I know I've seen a couple of things for people, but let's get more. Let's get more feedback from you guys, because we value what you think. We just want to make the show as best for you guys to listen to. So help us out, and we'll try to put one together. All right, Bix, you have it ready yet?
Okay. Yes. And also, I guess if by some chance we don't do the best of, I guess the Brawl for All Spectacular will be the 1 year anniversary show.
Okay. All right.
So, well, we were going to try to do a few different things, right? We were going to do some kind of non best of anniversary too. So we have a few ideas still.
Yeah, there's stuff in the ether.
Okay. Let's see. We've got Fight Club, a novel, and Fight Club 2, a graphic novel.
Not me, but that's a very interesting purchase there. I love Fight Club, the movie. So that sounds good.
Nutiva Organic Hemp Protein High Fiber 3-pound bag.
Not me, but you got to get your protein. That's for sure.
Let's see what this music is. Aerosmith, Night in the Ruts.
That's me. That's a great album. That's the album before. In fact, I think Joe Perry left Aerosmith as that album was being finished. Mm-hmm. And this is when it's 79. So I almost slept on, because once he left, like, the critics immediately like shit on it, and it didn't get as much pub as it should have gotten. But it was really a strong Aerosmith album.
What about Earth, Wind and Fire's I Am?
Another great album from 1979 purchased by me as I try to fill out my album connect collection.
One thing I've noticed lately with the CDs, you and whether other people buy, if you got Prime, you don't even have to get from the third party sellers. You can get these new for like $5 each from Amazon.
I know, man. It's a great deal.
It's a better deal than if you're getting it from MP3s.
I played a couple songs from I Am in band my freshman year of high school. I remember that. We played In the Stone and Star. We played.
Oh, yeah. In the Stone is a classic song. Earth, Wind, and Fire. If you were in high school and played in the band, you had to play Earth, Wind, and Fire at least once.
Oh, yeah.
Anything else big? So I know
I'm
there's
going to assume that the MP3 of 4th of July by Shooter Jennings featuring George Jones is you.
No, but that's awesome. Whoever did that, you are a great person. Yeah, that sounds awesome.
probiotics?
Not me. No.
A Canon ink cartridge.
No, but hey, you got to print your stuff out.
Probiotic
sure.
gummies.
No, not me on that one either.
Queen 40 Volume 2.
That's me. Okay. Amazon did a 3-volume set of Queen's entire catalog. And
is this like a special Amazon exclusive thing?
Amazon exclusive. Yes, where they put 5 albums together and it's two
just album collections.
They're 2 discs though. It's
so it's the special edition versions.
Yeah, special edition versions and I mean, 5 for $35 is a hell of a deal. Like, I just listened to Not the Opera yesterday. And
This one is the special edition versions of News of the World, Jazz, The Game, Flash, and Hot Spit.
News of the World, excuse me. Not News of the World.
Well, Flash, and, I presume, is Flash Gordon, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And Hot Spit.
And News of the World, the second disc on there has a – it's got 6 songs, a live cut, and some from the BBC – an alternate, and the stuff from the BBC sessions is fantastic. So, Queen. I mean, that's a great set. So,
rechargeable batteries.
No, but hell, everybody's got to have those.
Cuisinart knife set.
Not me. No, but you got to cook.
Paper.
Paper.
It goes with the inkjet.
There you go.
Oh no, DVD sleeves.
That's me. Okay. I ran out.
100 pack of Maxtec DVD sleeves, that's you?
Yeah, they didn't have the Memorex I like. So I bought Maxtec. I was in a crunch.
A Kindle?
No. That's a good purchase.
They bought it from a third party seller though.
Hey, sometimes you gotta go for the best deals.
What's a Kindle? You're not gonna get the best deal from a third party seller. Okay. Canadian Beaver Buzz Saska. What is this?
Sounds awesome.
Oh, it's an energy drink. Canadian Beaver Buzz Saskatoon Berry Flavor.
That's perfect after our last segment. Trent Walters didn't buy that, did he?
I was thinking it was Jordan Breen.
Maybe.
Teddy Hart.
If Teddy Hart listened to this show, I would die.
Gap Band 1, 2, and 3 is clearly you.
Nice.
Yes, although I do know that B.J. Whitmer is a fan of the Exile.
B.J. Whitmer just followed me on Twitter this week.
Yeah. I think he's maybe a fan of our show. Maybe a fan of Between the Sheets.
Heavy Traffic on Amazon Instant Video?
Not me.
Okay, that's it for everything.
All right, so that's a good mix there. A lot of different things. A lot of different selections. So keep on keeping on, guys. And if you want to... go through PayPal to support us, Bix. I'll let them know how they can do that.
Just send it through my PayPal, which is paypal.me/DavidBix. Just earmark in the comments what you want it for. If you want it for just to, as a donation, just to go be split up to the two of us, or if you want it to just be earmarked towards newsletter and other research expenses, etc.
There you go. All right. Now let's move back to the show. And God, I've just talked about this promotion for about 20 hours on the podcast. Continental Wrestling Federation and the Jerry Lawler Austin Idol AWA World Heavyweight Title match on July 2nd in Dothan, Alabama drew a $10,000 gate and had a very unique twist. Before the match started, Paulie Danielson shows up with an injunction which stated that he could be at ringside for this match because of the supposed terms in his previous contract with Austin Idol that if Idol ever got a world title match, that Dangerously would be his manager. However, Dangerously was basically working on behalf of Lawler in this match, although Lawler was acting like he didn't want him around either. The finish saw Idol catch Lawler in the figure four leg lock, or the Las Vegas leg lock, when Dangerously pulled the referee out of the ring and KO'd him with the phone. Eddie Gilbert didn't interfere and threw fire in Otto's face, so the fire actually missed. Earlier in the show, this is a TV taping, Lawler had a non-title match with Nightmare Ken Wayne, and Gilbert tried to throw fire at Lawler once again. Lawler ducked, and the fire went to the eyes of referee John Keaton.
Yeah, when they televised the match, this is on, I believe, the July 16th, they did the gimmick where Dangerously had to sit in a folding chair in the corner the whole time because neither of them wanted to have them as their manager, and it was kind of we're just waiting for him to interfere. We don't know which one he's going to interfere for, though. They're playing up that gimmick.
Yeah, but, God, you can't go wrong with Lawler, Isle, and Gilbert. Mm-hmm. It was just odd seeing Lawler working Continental Big. So it was just it was so different.
Yeah, I like the whole Lawler traveling champion thing too.
Yeah, that was good. He was going to different places, and they're firmly in with the AWA at this time period. So that's one good thing. But and Idol's
not a company champion.
And Idol's going back and forth between Continental USA, which is, you know, more about the incestual relationship coming. Mm. Ken Wayne is now teaming with a newcomer under mask called Nightmare Freddy. Being played, of course, by Doug Gilbert. But this is not your Nightmare Freddy you're used to. This Nightmare Freddy is basically Doug Gilbert in a black bodysuit. Where have you seen this before? In a old Nightmare's mask. From like the early days of the Nightmares. So it's not Freddy Krueger. And this didn't last very long.
Where did the Freddy name come from then?
From the movie.
But why was he called Freddy if he was... Never mind.
I guess because
it's still Nightmare on Elm Street. Yeah,
No, Wayne had brought him in because he was still feuding with Danny Davis.
Yeah, this is Nightmare. Yeah. And Wayne's a member of the first family. So it's only natural that Doug's his partner. But I guess the reason why Bix is that the next... What is it? What was the Nightmare on Elm Street movie?
Dream Warriors?
That was Dream Warriors, yes, with a great theme song by Dawkins. That was just coming out around this time period in the summer. So that was, probably why. Dream Warriors.
That reminds me, I was reading that thing on AV Club this week about the Scream series.
Yeah.
In the comments, there were a lot of people talking about a new Nightmare. And arguing that that's a better skewering of slasher movies than Scream was. So that made me want to see that. Have you ever seen New Nightmare? I've never seen New Nightmare.
Is this the one from what year?
It's the one where it's like about the cast of a Freddy Krueger movie. Where
Freddy Krueger is
a fictional character who's in horror movies in the universe.
Yeah, it's basically like it's kind of like a Spinal Tap, kind of, in a way, of a horror movie.
What I read that Wes Craven had said was like that it was New Nightmare is skewering of slasher movies from the perspective of the filmmaker. Scream is from the perspective of the consumer.
Yeah. Yeah, but Scream, though, brought back the genre. The genre was pretty much...
Right, is New Nightmare worth checking out if I've never seen it before?
I haven't seen it. I've just seen bits and pieces. And Robert Englund's playing like himself, and everybody's playing themselves. Right. So it's an interesting movie to watch.
Is what's-her-name
Heather Langenkamp's in there, himself. All right, Mr. Olympia was a match of the tape and revealing Jerry Stubbs, Bix.
Shocking. I would have thought that it would have revealed a Sheik.
Which must come as a major shock to almost everyone. Oh, me. Yeah, we talked about that on the Exile show where Jerry Stubbs was, when he's Jerry Stubbs, he was pretty much a heel every time. When he was Mr. Olympia, he was pretty much a babyface every time. Although there was... two instances where that was the opposite. But I love that.
He's one of those when he had the split with Arn and then he was going to, like, he lost a mask match or whatever, and he was like, no, I'm not unmasking. Wasn't that one of his heel turns that he refused to unmask after losing a mask match?
With Arn?
That they did a Mr. Olympia, Super Olympia mask match?
Yeah, I think so. That was the earliest one.
Right.
The other one's when he came back as Mr. Olympia with the stud stable, and then Bullet beat him for his mask. Because his deal was, he was the only masked man that could wear Cottonelle. And then Bullet took his mask. Kurt Hennig didn't make the tapings. And instead, we're for Don Owen in Portland. Yeah, Hennig was supposed to come in. And were. They had billed him to coming in. And didn't happen. And we'll talk more about him and Don Owen later.
Now, were they affiliated with was the Portland group affiliated with Continental at this time? Because I know Hennig was cutting promos about losing the AWA title, which I guess he could mention name drop AWA on that programming.
No, there's no Portland deal.
Okay.
They were all loosely affiliated with the AWA, though. But that's pretty much all there was.
Okay.
John Gallagher noted in the Wrestling Forum how fascinating it is, even though they're mostly in spot show towns, Continental has considerably more active schedule than the AWA. Well, who didn't in this time period?
Yeah, he said something like, it makes them look like a part-time wrestling promotion, which I guess they are.
Yeah, AWA was very lax in their schedule. Now, USA, of course, still in operation in Knoxville. Doug Furness beats Bill Dundee to win the vacant USA Heavyweight title in a tournament in Knoxville on July the 4th. Of course, USA owned by Ron Fuller. Continental still tied in a way with David Woods and Ron Fuller. Memphis is booked by Robert Fuller. World Class is starting to integrate itself with Jarrett Talent. So here's where your ancestral relationships all are coming from. Jerry Law is working every group, you know, so... And Jeff asked me about this before the show, so there it is, Jeff. That is why everybody's like tied in here.
Yeah, no, they had Max Payne and Fuller cut promos from Memphis, and they showed him on this, and then they, like I told you before the show, they used Crockett footage to build up Dundee and Armstrong on this, which was surprising enough because of course it went against everything that they'd have done to build up Jimmy Garvin as a face during that build.
Well, they didn't care. Jimmy Garvin didn't have a
promotion. No, as I said before, this is the week they debuted Tim Fry as the stormtrooper rappelling down from the roof.
Yeah, which you talked about on Exile on Bad Street.
But he wasn't the Nazi stormtrooper yet, right?
Or yes,
he was.
Oh,
he was
Yeah, Ron Wright
had
Nazi flag.
I thought he had non-Nazi appearances first.
No, not here.
No, he comes out with Ron Wright with a spray painted swastika on his gear. So
Ron Wright said this is his flag, not the Nazi flag.
Yeah, no, they played a Jerry Lawler music video on this one also to hype Lawler.
They're bringing him in as a heel and they're playing the Babyface music video.
Which one?
The Warrior.
Oh, Warrior by Scandal.
Mm-hmm.
But USA Wrestling, I prefer it over Continental. And that's not slight Continental, because I thought it was great too, but I always dug USA.
More like old Continental.
Yeah. And I'd like to get you guys' thoughts on it. I mean, what did you prefer? We'll start with you, Jeff.
I actually liked the Continental presentation a little bit more just because I thought, you know, some of the Ron Wright's cast of characters were fun, don't get me wrong, but it took me out of it just a little bit. You know, you had the Stomper, you had the Dog, you had the Stormtrooper, and then you had the Bodyguard, who he didn't last very long, did he?
Story about that on Exile on the fourth show.
No, I preferred Continental over this, even though it was a lot of stud stable stuff on there. Or no, I'm mixing that up with CWA and CWF. My fault. It was just a little bit more southern edginess to the Continental product. But I know we disagree on that slightly.
All right, Bix, what you think?
I think I kind of prefer USA because in part, like, I'm a big Eddie Gilbert mark.
Yeah,
but from what I've seen, like the way the production values are down during the period he's there, and all that, it just feels kind of like off to a degree. Like, he's doing good work, the booking's interesting, he's doing a lot of interesting things, you know, giving the Alan Martin the push and all that. But I don't know if it all clicks necessarily, like for me, the way it should.
Well, it's like I said to Jeff before the show, they were doing different stuff. So it was needed in that time period. They needed to have a different voice, a different look. But Eddie's issues with David Woods, of course, led to him leaving. So it didn't last
long. The one thing that USA was doing more than other promotions is they were doing different twists on guys that we had already seen. Like, I love the Nelson Royal heel character here.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Which was they had done it a little bit in Crockett, but not to this extent. I mean, Nelson Royal was fantastic on promos in this period.
Have you ever seen the Nelson Royal stuff he did for George Cannon, like in the late 70s, early 80s?
I haven't.
The promos he did, those are really good. Chris, I sent you that at some point, right?
Yeah, many years ago.
That stuff's really, really good.
It's a shame we don't have more of that stuff on film, on tape.
What, just George Cannon stuff in general?
All this that weird stuff. I mean, it was just so different than anything else that you watched at the time period.
I mean, I probably prefer Continental just because I'm also an Eddie Gilbert mark, but they're basically doing the same stuff with Gilbert and Lawler that they did everywhere else.
Yeah, pretty much. All right, speaking of Memphis, and I love this, is John Gallagher from the WrestleForum starts out, "If you enjoy Robert Fuller, this is the promotion for you." And, buddy, you got that right. July 3rd at the Mid-South Coliseum.
There you go, Tennessee's done.
Yeah. July 3rd, they ran on Sunday. They got away from the 4. Drew an impressive crowd of 5,000 fans. Mainly to see the return of Jimmy Valiant. Results of the card saw Bunkhouse Brown pin Alan Reynolds. Bix, we had the clip of why Brickhouse Brown is now Bunkhouse Brown. And let's hear the explanation of this. Oh, of course.
let me skip it.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Are we just skipping to the promo, I guess?
Yeah. To that part.
Yeah, because we've got a Matt part. Okay.
What an interesting one. The way Gilbert took care of his own business right back, but he was kind of sorry that he did because he didn't count on that many people jumping on him. Well, here they come, the illustrious stud stable, downtown Bruno, Robert Fuller, gorgeous Gary Sylvia.
I want to say, you know, there's that Tommy Gilbert. They just showed the film of him out there, man, just stepping on the wrong place, baby, because what happened, Gilbert, as you know, I went to you just some time ago, and I said, let me make you a little deal to get here in the stable. He said, I want some time to think about it. I thought I would come down there and benefit you a little bit, because let's face it, Dutch Mantell was kicking your butt from one end of that ring to the other. I went down there and took care of Mantell, and what did I have to do? Take care of you, too, because you're a dummy, son. And because you're a dummy, this is what we do for dummies here, baby. We got a man here who takes care of dummies. I'm talking about one of the toughest men in my stable, Jerry Young right here. Jerry, can you take that punk out or what?
Not only can I take you out, Tommy Gilbert, I can destroy you. Now, brother, I remember you from about 12, 13 years ago, you know, and the only thing that's changed is that I was a snot-nosed punk then. Now I'm not. You're an old man. You understand what I'm saying? A little bit of speed, a little bit of agility, a little bit of feeble-mindedness, maybe.
You may
so,
find out.
Tommy Gilbert, you bring all you got. I know you got a lot of experience, but try to muster up enough speed and enough energy to face me for just 15 minutes.
You know, Lance, I don't make many predictions, but I'm going to make one right here. I guarantee it'll come through. That just as sure as that Gilbert took a walk, I'm talking about Eddie and his girlfriend, that the old man's going to be falling in his tracks because my man Gary's taking him right out. Now, here's a special moment. This is something we've been waiting on here. We got a new inductee into our stable here. We got a new man I'm talking about, baby. I'm talking about one of the toughest cowboys come down the back. I'm talking about Bunkhouse Brown. Bring him on out.
Brickhouse Brown.
Bunkhouse. That ain't Bunkhouse. Bunkhouse Brown. This boy's doing all the way.
Let's you and I get one thing straight right now. I ain't nobody's boy.
Cowboy! Cowboy! Buckhouse Brown! He's my new cowboy! Show him your muscle!
Cowboy!
A little touchy there, isn't it, Lance? We got enough on that.
Robert, I...
Listen, we got some other things to move along too, Brick. Just don't take up all the screen because you're looking good there, baby. Cowboy hat and all. Brick, I told, because he's had this manager I'm talking about, Brother Ernest Angel, that's a nothing happening manager that's easy to see. He's not getting nothing done. Brick's not the CCW champion, and the clear reason is not Max Payne. The problem is Brother Angel I'm talking about. So what we're going to do is set Brother Angel back over in the corner somewhere. I'm going to take over the reins on this man, and within 30 days, I'm going to guarantee he's got the title. And that's where my man Hickerson comes in. Come on over here, Phil. We can get this limelight a little bit,
Max
baby.
Payne, right?
Well, you know what? I'm going to be right with Max Payne. You know, we said we're going to get a belt.
Phil Hickerson, baby.
We're going to get that belt. Well, let me tell you something, man, Maxie. You know, you better take and do a lot of researching on Phil Hickerson, because I was the one that had the international belt right here so long that they just retired that belt and I got it in the house. So what I'm going to do when I get in the ring with you, brother, I don't have to paint my face up because I'm pretty, I ain't bad and ugly like you, but you're going to see how bad I am. Ask the people about Phil Hickerson. Ask the promoters everywhere you go about Phil Hickerson. And one thing about it, brother, you're going to see a new champion, and I just might give Bunk that belt.
Also, note that Robert referred to it as the CCW belt.
Yes, I was going to say that. How much cocaine was used on that group there? Wow. But describe what Bunkhouse Brown was wearing, Vic.
Cowboy hat?
Yes.
Very nice cowboy hat. I'm like, kind of like a, what would you call this? Like a nice cowboy kind of like shirt?
Denim shirt, yes. Denim shirt. Jeans.
Jeans.
Cowboy boots.
Yeah. He was dressed
right. Glove. Now, here's the thing though. His gimmick before this, like right before, he was like this Miami gangster type deal.
And before that, he was an African prince.
He was before that, an African prince. Now he's Bunkhouse Brown. And this is, of course, not too long before they do the watermelon angle with him, which we talked about that on Exxon Bad Street from the latest episode. But because they rehashed it in Continental.
Of course they did. But,
well, this kind of stuff had been surrounding his character anyways, because they were plugging on the July 2nd show, the cage match with Max Payne and Ernest Angel is just all going off on how Brickhouse Brown's, some of his relatives were held in cages this whole time. And you're just like, my God! And this was my first real exposure to Ernest Angel. I had heard about him on the show, but I thought he was a fantastic manager. Probably running a little bit too loose on the lips there at times. But,
well,
but the whole Jim Baker Wrestling Village USA gimmick, I thought was fantastic.
No, he was awesome.
What did
he
you think awesome. Of the fans chanting, "He's got AIDS"? Or was that not on the show you watched?
That wasn't on the show I watched.
Oh, but, crazy to explain that.
But that is totally 1988 for you.
Okay. I'm not going to explain it here. I'll give you a place to... All right. The Wrestling Why We Manage podcast, Al Getz and Dan Wilson are friends. Mm-hmm. WrestlingWars.com. I did a show with them talking about Memphis managers from post-Jimmy Hart until 1990. And I tell a story on the show about Brother Ernest Angel and the fans chanting, "He's got AIDS." So go check that out on WrestlingWars.com, the Why We Manage podcast. I think it was two podcasts ago that I was on there, episode 9, I think. It was the one after J.J. Dillon. So go check that out and listen to that show, because there's some really good stories on that show. But Brother Ernest Angel, and I tell the story of how he got into the business and other stuff too. So go check that out. All right. Sean Baxter, also discussed on Exxon Bad Street, beat Don Bass by DQ in a star and quarter match. Gary Young beat Tommy Gilbert. Went downtown Bruno to distract the referee. Fuller hit Gilbert with a foreign object. 2.5-star match. Listen to this tag team. Billy Joe Travis and Scott Steiner, that's right, were scheduled to defend their CWA tag titles against, listen to this tag team, Bob Holly and Pat Rose.
I can actually think of a lot of things that Billy Joe Travis and Scott Steiner have in common.
Which would have been a good match. However, Rose and Holly quit earlier that night, and they got David Price, who was jobbing like crazy on Crockett Television, And one of my favorite names of any wrestler in this era, Van Van Horn, to come in on short notice as the River City Bombers, managed by Brother Ernest Angel, who got on the mic, buried Rhodes and Holly, saying they basically weren't any good. Travis is starting to win the match, chain of title, 2.5-star match. Phil Hickerson used a chain to beat Max Payne and won the CWA heavyweight title in a 3-star match, which I kind of like, want to see that match. Jimmy Valiant was scheduled to wrestle the Senshi, the Great Senshi, which ended with Fuller, Golden, Bruno, and Sylvia all interfering, jumping Valiant. They cut off his beard to set up a big feud. During the altercation, a female fan attacked Sylvia, and they got out of hand before it was broken up. Yeah, there we go.
I wonder if this was Emily. I wonder if this was Emily Arthur, because they had brought her out on TV.
It probably was. It probably was, and not Emily Arthur. Emily Arthur. You always gotta make that distinction. A previous episode between the
sheets. They both had 80s hair, though.
In more ways than one. The main event featured Jerry Lawler and Jeff Jarrett against Robert Fuller and Jimmy Golden. Ended with a DQ as the heels had Tojo Yamamoto and Shinsuke interfere. And once again, they tried to re-break Jarrett's arm. However, Valiant made the save in a 3.5-star match. Valiant has always been a big drawing card in Memphis on the short-term basis. He'll be around for about a month, Dave was told. But Dave guesses he's finally through with Crockett, which seemed inevitable for a long time. Actually, the only reason Valiant stuck around for as long as he did was because he was under contract and waiting for the balloon payment on his contract, and I guess he got tired of waiting. Which, you know, we talked about that, Bix, on the 88 Def of Crockett show and those balloon payment deals. But Valiant, you wouldn't have known he was still there because he was never on television. I think after Starrcade 87 he may be on television like a couple of times. But other than that, all he did was house shows in the Carolinas.
Just to see shows, right? Yeah.
Yes. Basically, it was him and Bugsy McGraw working as the Green Machine. That was like the running match.
Who was the Green Machine again?
Bugsy McGraw.
Oh, I thought you said Bugsy McGraw against the Green Machine. I forgot Bugsy McGraw was the Green
Machine. Bugsy has the Green Machine.
This Pat Rose, Bob Holly team, something. They're on the TV I watched. they're both dressed in pink and black like the Hart Foundation. And probably according to what Bob Holly has said, it was probably Pat Rose left and he said, Bob Holly, you're coming with me when he quit. But Pat Rose had a blonde mullet.
Yeah, he dyed his hair.
Yeah, it looked like a cross between Ken Wayne and Mike Enos. In that time, oh. I was like, I had never seen Pat Rose look like this, but I guess Holly kept this gear throughout even his Smoky Mountain run in 92, because he was wearing pink and black throughout that as well when it was Hollywood Bob Holly, so that got a kick out of me.
And they came in from WOW, which had closed up by this time, you know, the promotion that was based out of Mobile, and they were up here with Bernard Ernest, and they didn't last too long, though, but Jimmy Valiant in Memphis. This is Jimmy's first match in Memphis since 85.
Mm-hmm.
And he stuck around for a little bit.
Since he was handsome.
Well, he was always handsome in Memphis.
Yeah.
Always. Even with Hina the Boogie Woogie Man, they would still call him Handsome Jimmy Valiant.
True.
So
did they call him handsome when he came back, though, in 89-90?
Yeah.
Or did they start calling him Boogie Woogie?
I think they started calling him Boogie Woogie Man more in that era. But he was still handsome for a lot of this era.
And he would start doing the promos or would call himself, or at least just uttering the words, boogie, woogie.
Yeah.
More during that period. Yeah.
Speaking of Emily Arthur is back. Team with Tojo Yamamoto against mm-hmm. Downtown Bruno and Sylvia.
Yeah, she was on this week's television.
And again, that's Emily Arthur.
And now let's go to Windy City Wrestling, the original WCW, Sam DeCero's group, booked by Paul E. Dangerously.
Well, not the original WCW.
Well, kind of.
In the
United States, let's put that way.
Well, I guess you can kind of count Georgia, though.
Yeah, but they were still GCW, but yeah, it kind of. The word that Dave has got is they've signed an exclusive deal with the International Amphitheater in Chicago. They'll be running shows there every 6 weeks. Paul Danielson, who handles the booking here, will also manage Eddie Gilbert, Colonel DeBeers, Dennis Condrey, and Randy Rhoads. And they had a pretty successful run, Bix, for a while there.
Yeah, definitely. They would draw pretty well doing your indie dream matches and stuff. Like your, what's it, like we talked about, the Battle of the Bam Bams, Bruiser Brody against John Nord. I'm trying to think, what else did they run during this period?
No, Patera came in after WWF and then did the Patera stuff. Trying to remember what else they ran.
Lots of Max Brothers main events, of course.
Mad Max and Super Max, yeah. Let's see. I'm trying to find a good car. Okay, here's a World Windy City Wrestling card from September 30th, not the Bam Bam matches. Condrey, Gilbert, and Rose over the Terminators and Thor.
The Terminators are who? Mike Laurinaitis, I guess.
I think they're Sharky's guys. I think they would have been the guys that played Riggs and Wolf. The Memphis Terminators.
Oh, okay.
Then you had a Lumberjack with Bats match for the WCW Heavyweight title. As Mr. Electricity Steve Regal defeated Colonel DeBeers to retain his title. And then you're Battle of the Bam Bams.
That would be a main event in any godforsaken Midwest town. And,
and Battle of the Bam Bams?
No, what about it?
So you said, would that be the main event?
No, I was talking about Mr. Electricity versus
Steve Regal.
Yeah.
Wait, all right, here's an August the 12th show.
Okay.
Larry Cameron over Stormy Granzig.
Granzig?
Yeah.
Good old Lethal Larry.
Yeah. The Windy City Dream Team over Buddy Rose and Doug Summers by disqualification. Don't know who the Windy City Dream Team was. Conjure Rose over the Terminators. Regal over the Bears by DQ. Abdul the Butcher over Frank Nelson. And Bam Bam Bigelow won
a... Frank Nelson or Frank Melson?
Frank Nelson. And Bam Bam Bigelow won a 60-man battle royal. So there you go.
Are you sure? You're sure this is not Frank the Tank Melson?
It said Frank Nelson.
Do we know if Frank Melson ever wrestled as Frank Nelson?
I don't know. Anyway, let's move on. Thanks, Chris. World class.
The Windy City Dream Team was Lance Allen and Eddie Strong. Okay.
Interesting. Was Phil Robinette or whatever his name was the announcer at this point?
I think
Bill
so.
Bill Robinette.
Yeah.
Bill Robinette, who, if you've never seen him, looks like the fake Earl of Monsoon from the Jesse Ventura NBC biopic.
Oh, my God. All right, let's go to World Class. And Bix, what does Wrestling Forum have to say?
Yes, I did not have time to type this entry up, so I'm reading this straight from the print newsletter, as you may or may not hear on my microphone. I hate it when I have to start off a report like this, but there's something I can't give you the complete details on. I understand that a wrestler here, I don't reveal names until a new newspaper reports it for fear of libel, was served with an arrest warrant a week ago accusing him of statutory rape. One guess who it was, though. From what I can gather, the promotion managed to keep it out of the local press, but when it comes to trail, they won't be able to. It says he typed trail by mistake instead of trial. It has been a major topic conversation among the wrestlers, not only from here, but also from the other promotions as well.
Now, I don't know if we're going to speculate on the air here, but look at the roster when you get a chance of World Class from summer 1988 or this time period. And you made the decision. You think it probably was. Because there are some candidates. Sad to say.
Would it be a wrestler who just left for the WWF?
Could be. Who knows? All right. Anyway, let's go what we do know.
Well, we know it wasn't a black girl, if that's the case.
Oh, God. According to John Gallagher in Wrestling Forum, Eric Embry has taken over Michael Hayes as the booker after Hayes resigned. He wasn't bringing in the houses up enough to justify his continued employment in the role. Hayes will continue to have input, but the direction of the promotion will be changing. I'll say this was ended up being a great move, Bix, in the long run, for sure.
Yeah, although as always with this topic, you look at it on paper and you would not think it would have. Hello?
Go on.
I was curious to see what you said to that.
Yeah. I thought you were just pausing, but...
No.
Yeah.
No, I know I do that a lot. Because it's he had not been a big name anywhere. But he ended up slowly but surely booking things around himself, downplaying the Von Erichs, everything that you would think would not work. And then it worked, and it drew, and they drew, actually drew fairly well. And he drew the last real sellout ever at the Sportatorium, you know, a little over a year later. And Hayes, I guess Hayes was still booking his own program, right? Hello? I'm asking you something.
Yeah, I had myself on mute. Yeah, Hayes was still booking. Yeah, Hayes was, it was Hayes and Costco's SST.
Right, and I would think because he was we were already in the middle of that program, I would think that he was still booking that. And then, now I'm trying to remember, when does Embry turn face and when does he really ramp everything up?
In November?
So it takes a while before it becomes the Eric Embry show.
Yes. Yes, they do the Devastation Incorporated deal where he's trying to get him to join in October-ish. It's after the Cotton Bowl or around the Cotton Bowl time period. So
they hadn't gotten to the Cox program yet, had they? They were still kind of teasing with the. They're teasing the odd couple of wrestling with Kerry and Hayes.
The Freebirds reunion as well. I think, you know, kind of.
Buddy Jack had turned and joined with the new Samoan Freebirds, the SST.
Buddy Hackett?
Yes.
Buddy Roberts?
I said Buddy Jack.
Oh, I said Buddy Hackett.
No. That would have been a hell of a team right there. No. They were doing – it was weird because they were booking everybody against everybody here, I think, because it's like, you know, he had Hayes cutting promos for the Kerry Hayes team while also cutting that he was bringing in Steve Cox to help him.
It was Steve, like, do okay. It to it, Cox.
Yeah. What?
Now, a woman who kissed on a very first date is usually a hussy. And a woman who kissed on the second time out is anything but fussy. But a woman who wait till the third time around, head in the clouds, feet on the ground, she's the girl he's glad he's found. She's his shapoopy, 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 shapoopy.
Buddy Hackett, folks.
Shapoopy, shapoopy, shapoopy.
All right, that's enough of that.
But there's a great Buddy Hackett story from the Tonight Show. You got to see it on YouTube. Just search Buddy Hackett, Johnny Carson. It'll come up. But, yeah, you're right. Yeah, Hayes was cutting promos for everybody this time period. And for good reason.
Mm-hmm.
All right. July 1st at a sports...
Wait, would this be Buddy Hackett, Johnny Carson duck joke?
Don't know if it's that way in particular. But July 1st, Sportatorium drew on 1,100 fans. Your main event was Kevin and Kerry Von Erich over Terry Taylor and Iceman King Parsons.
The odd couple of wrestling.
Yes. When Kevin pinned Taylor to regain the held up world class tag team titles. The belts had been held up when the two teams bounced to a double disqualification in Dallas on June the 10th. Also on the card, Michael Hayes beat Buddy Roberts in a Bad Street match. Although after the match, Roberts used his loaded glove on Hayes, which is a karate. Oh, excuse me. He used his loaded glove on Hayes. A karate glove boxing match took place between Sean Simpson and Jack Victory, ending in the fifth
round. Glove boxing match?
Yes. When Roberts came out to punch Simpson with his loaded glove, but he ducked, Victory took the punch, and Simpson got the KO win. Terry Taylor and Steve Casey were the seconds. And during the match, at one point, Terry Taylor threw a Coke in Simpson's eyes. A Coke, not some Coke. Steve Casey pinned Eric Embry in the first match of their best-of-three series for the World Class Light Heavyweight title, with the second match taking place on July 4th, and the rubber match, more often than not, happening on July 8th at the Sportatorium. Bush, the Samoan SWAT team, Samoa Fatu, who Dave says is a very good team, by the way, beat Skip Young and Solomon Grundy.
That Eric Embry versus Steve Casey feud was easily the greatest thing that Steve and Dane ever did in pro wrestling.
Inside the Ring, other, definitely.
Yes.
Other than getting mist blown in his face by Muda?
Well, yeah, he did have that one match with Muda.
No, I mean, you watch those matches with Embry, and you think he's going to be something. I mean, those are really
he
good
had
matches.
The look. You know, he looked like bootleg Stan Lane. I mean, he had a look. He, you know, he had some ability.
Couldn't talk,
though, for sure.
Well, except for that wondrous exchange on commentary with Doyle King about AIDS and Gullible. where Doyle King's asking him if he practices safe sex, and he says no, and Doyle King's like, what, you don't care about AIDS? an unusual Doyle King impression for me, I guess.
Yes, it was. For just age topping in wrestling. It's twice on the show.
I know.
World Class back in the day would have run July 4th at the Tarrant County Convention Center in Fort Worth, the big building. Yeah. You know, 16,000 fans. 1988, they run the Sportatorium. They drew 3,000 fans, though, and nearly $500 a ticket. Kerry Von Erich beat Kamala by disqualification to keep the World Class title in the main event when Buddy Roberts and Iceman Parsons interfered. Michael Hayes got Buddy's glove, using the KO Buddy Roberts and their glove on a pole match. Then we had the Simpsons, Steve over Sean.
Go ahead. Casey really could have used a glove on a pole match.
The Simpsons went over John Tam and Jack Victory by disqualification when Buddy Roberts gave John Tam the free bird hair cream. But when he tried to rub it in Steve Simpson's eyes, the cream went everywhere and they called the DQ. That's right. The free bird hair cream is here. Eric Embry beat Steve Casey in their second match to set up that third match, which would take place in a steel cage. Samoan SWAT team beat the Missing Link and his son, Jason Sterling. And then a Texas Bull Rope match with Wobbler and Black Bart in the DQ and Skinder Abar interfered. Later in the card, Buddy Roberts came out and asked Michael Hayes to come out, and he begged him to take him back. While he was begging forgiveness, the SST attacked Hayes, and Roberts just stood by. And when they were through, he grabbed back the black glove that Hayes had taken from him earlier in the card. Kevin Von Erich was supposed to wrestle Terry Taylor on the card. They wrestled the night before in Fort Worth with Taylor doing a clean job in 4 minutes. And Frank Dusick announced Taylor was injured so badly, he couldn't wrestle. So Kevin was given the Texas Heavyweight title by forfeit. Pretty bad when the best wrestler on the card doesn't show up in a match they've been hyping for so long. Biggs.
Yes.
How about Terry Taylor here?
How about him?
You know why he's leaving.
Gotta go be the cock of the walk. Yeah.
Yeah. Why couldn't they do the Texas title in Fort Worth?
Because wrestling.
And Frank Dusick, of course, is here as the authority figure.
Captain Frank Dusick.
That's right. In World Class, which he was the authority figure for about a year or so. Wow.
Until the World Class Board of Directors was taken over by the evil Tojo Yamamoto.
That's right.
And his cronies. And Frank Dusick had to join up with the USWA.
That's right.
Which, of course, oversees World Class and the CWA, and did they also say that World Class, that the USWA was the governing body of Continental too? At least at the beginning.
I think so. Yeah,
because Continental was still sort of in that mix.
Yeah. Now, a name here that always brings a smile on my face every time I see it come up: Jason Sterling. Tell me about Jason Sterling,
son of Link. He was this tiny little dude who took great bumps, very good worker, and just had the career you would expect a tiny little dude who took great bumps to have in this period. My favorite Jason Sterling memory, besides the matches he had with Embry, I guess maybe we're sensing a pattern. There's this one clip years ago. I put it on YouTube. I think I've told you this story, right?
Yes.
Where it's Jason Sterling and I don't remember who he's teaming with. Against John Tatum and Jack Victory. And one of Jason Sterling's regular spots would be that his opponent would duck down for a back body drop. He would jump, and he was barefoot, remember? He would jump on their back and jump off behind them and then throw a drop kick or whatever. Here, they did a blind tag. He jumped onto Victory's back, and then Tatum came in flying with a top rope clothesline. And it's a really cool looking spot. And I put it on YouTube as something like, you know, John Tatum and Jack Victory kill Jason Sterling. All of a sudden, I see it's done like, you know, 150,000 views or whatever. This is years ago. I start looking at the comments. It's people that were looking for, like, brutal, like, murder videos and were searching for the word kills. Angry that it was just some fake wrestling bullshit. I'm like, this isn't, you're not really kill, you stupid motherfucker, you idiot. Like, what are you talking about? And I believe I changed the title to something like, John Tatum and Jack Victory kill Jason Sterling, like, figuratively speaking.
People want to see that murder of Jason Sterling. Seems to thought that Ken Mantell wasn't going to run the promotion to preserve the Von Erich legacy has gone out the window. Kevin holds the Texas title, carried the world title. Kevin and Kerry the tag titles. Kevin, Kerry, and Hayes the 6-man tag titles.
I forgot they even still had the 6-man tag titles.
Yeah, but Jeff, that's amazing how the Von Erichs held all the belts in world class, huh?
All the major ones. They had some minor ones going because I know that Tatum and Victory had the Wild West tag champs.
That's right.
I believe,
yeah.
And the Texas
state
champs.
Doing that, yeah. Texas tag titles. That's what it was.
Yeah, well, they had both. They said Wild West and Texas tag titles.
No, there were three titles. There were the Texas tag titles, the Wild West tag titles, and the World Class World Tag Team titles. And eventually, the Samoan SWAT team held all three.
Yeah, they combined it. The other thing on TV that was interesting about this is they're plugging the Triple Dome of Terror match, the second one. And I guess the story there is that Michael Hayes had a falling out with Dusty, and he went over to World Class, and he had heard him and Sullivan talking about the three cage match, which would eventually become the Tower of Doom, which happens over the summer.
He stole it and used it, yes.
except they have to climb up. This is the most ridiculous looking match.
The cages are in the ring.
Yeah, the cages are inside the ring and they're tiny, and then they climb up. It's kind of like feast or famine for rewards at the top cage.
Yeah, no wonder Jason Sterling was one of the winners with how small those cages were.
Hey, Brickhouse Brown should have been in it. His people were in cages.
Oh, jeez.
Come on now.
Hey, Brother Ernest said that. Anyway, Crockett, speaking of them, ran July 4th at Reunion Arena. They drew 5,000 fans, so in direct competition. Main event was Dusty Rhodes and Lex Luger over Ric Flair and Barry Windham in a match refereed by David Manning. When Dusty pinned Windham, plus you had the Road Warriors against Ivan, the Russian Assassin, in a scaffold match.
I'm
How about that,
craving
Vic?
Some Dairy Queen, and I have no idea why.
How about David Manning as a referee on a Crockett show, huh?
I assume he's been kicked out at this point for alleged thievery and other skullduggery.
Why take a vacation when you could take a paycation?
That's right. He did nothing wrong. David Manning. It's interesting. You would have thought how close he was with Flair, and that Flair would have got him a job. But I guess he had enough money from doing other things. All right. Let's move to the Pacific Northwest. And they ran Portland on July 2nd. Matt Bourne beat the Grappler, Lynn Denton, a survival match. Both men were tied to the corner. First guy that got loose could pound on the other guy who was still tied up. Interesting match. Mike Golden beat the Avalanche in a steel cage match. Of course, Avalanche would become PNUs in a future life. Colonel the Bears beat the Assassin in a coal miner's glove match. Of course, the Assassin was Dave Sierra, and this is his best run of his career. Loved him in Portland as Assassin and Top Gun. Kurt Hennig beat Buddy Rose. It would sound like an amazing match. Mike Golden beat Moondog Moretti. Then we had Billy Two Eagles go to a draw with Moretti. And Steve Dahl bought Al Madrill to a draw in a bunkhouse match.
How does a bunkhouse match go to a draw?
I wonder what Steve Dahl wore in his bunkhouse match, Biggs.
Definitely a fanny pack.
Had to have been like a Poison shirt or something like that, I'm sure. But, yeah, this is Lynn Denton in full effect booking in Portland. And that's some really good television this era, for sure. Did you get any of that, Jeff? Were you able to find Portland TV?
I've only seen like earlier Portland TV, not this era.
Yeah, in Portland this era was like, it's like Memphis in a lot of ways. It's had that Memphis feel, but a West Coast version of it.
Right.
It was like now, it was Memphis run by dirty hippies.
Now, speaking of Buddy Rose, the next night in Milwaukee, Oregon, he was in a dunk tank because he lost to Curt Hennig. So he said he lost it, he would be in a dunk tank. And he was. And he held his step up. Now, this show drew 600 fans. Matt Bourne beat the Grappler in a cage match. Dahl beat Madrill, this time in a bull rope match, and Juiced Hardway, which, of course, they couldn't blade no more, Bix, in Oregon.
Yes, that what was the commissioner's name? Anderson?
Yeah.
Something Anderson?
Yep. Buddy Rose beat the Assassin. Yeah.
Jeff?
Brad. Buddy Rose beat the Assassin in a Loser Leave Town chain match, which, of course, would lead to the Top Gun gimmick coming to fruition.
Now, wait, was Mike Top Gun supposed to be the same person as the Assassin?
They sure did talk the same. There was no difference in the voice. It was kind of like Dusty as the Midnight Rider and that type of deal. You know, although it's a masked guy becoming... Well, he had lost his mask by that point, so... You know, it is what it is. Everybody knew who it was. Golden drew to Avalanche. De Beers beat Hennig by DQ. Yes, Curt Hennig is still a babyface here in Portland. And we have Scott Peterson over the Terminator, which is interesting. And we have Billy Two Eagles over C.W. Bergstrom.
Now, which Terminator is this?
That's why it's interesting, because at this time period, and we're close to the end of this, but Don Owen actually has opposition as the Oregon Wrestling Federation is in existence, which is Billy Jack Haynes's promotion. And he's running against Don Owen and stole some of Don Owen's talent. And it was a real bad deal. Some real bad blood there, Bix.
Also, didn't he name it the Oregon Wrestling Federation so he could false advertise the idea that he was bringing in WWF wrestlers?
Yes. Yes. And it was some real bad blood between Billy and Don, but Don took him back. Of course, and Billy returned a year later, but this was a big, big deal because Billy went to press and was just, he was doing all kinds of shit for old Don. You remember what all he was saying? He was really exposing some stuff. I can't remember all of what he was saying. You remember any of that?
Yeah, didn't he say he was Daniel Benoit's real father?
No. No. Oh, my God.
Oh, that was a different wrestling promoter. That's right.
All right, OWF on July 2nd, Oregon City. And Mike Miller over Tiger Chung Lee. Brian Adams, that's right, Crush, over the Terminator, which was Mark Laurinaitis.
So is Terminator the only guy working for both groups?
I don't think it was. I don't think it was the same one. Could have been, but I don't think so. Coco Samoa beat Lex Luthor. Then we had Corporal Kirshner over Joey Jackson. And then Kevin Kelly beat Brock Gardner. And we had Coco Samoa, who is now turned heel and is managing Tiger Chung Lee in his feud with Mike Miller. So that's OWF. And according to Wrestling Forum, Johnny Ace will be returning to the OWF after a Japanese tour and his engagement. Not to Mrs. Bella just yet, but... It's first wife.
Mrs. Baba?
No, not Mrs. Baba. But, Jeff, you read that talent roster for Billy Jack Haynes' group, and you can see that the end is near.
Oh, yeah. I'm. Who's Lex Luthor? My goodness.
I don't know.
And this Kevin Kelly, this is the man who became Nails later, correct?
I hope so.
Yeah, okay.
Was this total wreckage, Lex Luthor?
I don't know about all that. Total Rack is Lex Luthor. Wow. All right, Bob Backlund. Let's go to Poopery. Bob Backlund's interviewed in a Japanese magazine and basically did leave his options open for returning to Japan as a wrestler. Backlund said he went wrestling the NWA because he couldn't earn the money that the top NWA guys get. Backlund had been contacted by both New Japan and the UWF to wrestle this year, so he may be returning after all. Well, he did. He worked Takada and in UWF. He never went back to anything about New Japan.
He had a really good match with Takada, too.
Yeah. I couldn't.
Had he not been wrestling at all since, I guess, 85?
Yeah. Because he had done indie shots in 85. He has a little indie promotion he was running.
He worked for Savoldi. He worked for Pro Wrestling USA.
He had, Northeast Wrestling or something like that was his promotion that he ran for a little bit.
Now, was his group the one that was helping promoting, like, the early, like, Crockett expansion shows in Philly and stuff?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was, like, Northeast Wrestling or whatever it was. So, yeah, I mean, it didn't last very long, and he became, like, a coach and shit like that, so. According to Wrestling Forum, Body Slam, starring Roddy Piper, Tonga Kid, Dirk Benedict, Captain Lou Albano, The Barbarian, TJ Khan, and others, should be out on home video any day now. Gallagher wrote that it never hit theaters, which is incorrect, according to IMDb. Yeah, it wasn't in the theaters. Jeff, have you ever seen this movie?
Yeah, I did a while ago.
What did you think of that flick?
It's absolutely dreadful.
How dare you?
Although, oddly enough, I didn't watch it for the wrestling part. I watched it for Dirk Benedict being in wrestling, since I was a big A-team mark at the time or earlier.
How about Flair being in the movie?
And Bruno,
yeah. I don't have a memory of it, though. I watched it like when it first came out on video, and I haven't seen it since. I know it would run occasionally on like some outpost cable station at 2 in the morning.
It would be on TV a lot, actually. It would be in syndication. It would be on USA. It would be on HBO a lot early on.
It aired every now and then. Yeah, I remember seeing it. I just thought it was so odd. You get the NWA and WWF guys on the same movie.
Well, also, I'm wondering as far as then went, how it must not have been in theaters to any great degree, though.
Probably not.
But I'll always have a soft spot for that movie. Billy Barty as another heel manager.
Yes.
Using a word that we can't use anymore, or that no one can use anymore, and rightfully so. Lou Albano being Captain Lou Morano for some reason.
Very
Harry Smilak inventing the Rock and Wrestling Connection.
Yeah, of course. All right. In Wrestling Forum, Dwight Decker wrote a detailed letter asking for more coverage of GLOW and POW, including an explanation of how Dave McLean's departure from GLOW and the staggered production schedules led to the same wrestlers being on both shows with different names. Now, GLOW is trying to refinance itself, taking new investors to get enough capital together to film a new season this fall. In other words, they are in pretty bad financial shape.
So I guess this is right before Jackie Stallone comes in, I guess.
Yeah. But Bix, you gotta, what was the difference between GLOW and POW?
So apparently Dave McLean went into GLOW wanting it to be like more of a straightforward wrestling promotion. And POW was theoretically his idea of like hard-nosed women's wrestling, except it wasn't. I'm trying to figure out the best way to describe this. It's like, it's a toned down GLOW, but it's also not really serious wrestling either.
Well, they did have Dick the Bruiser on there as the color announcer.
Yes, it was under the governance of the WWA. That's true. And now who? Which of the talent were in both promotions? I'm trying to remember. So you've got Queen
Kong.
Well, which was first? Was she which was first? Matilda the Hun or Queen Kong? Which was
Matilda the Hun.
So she's Matilda the Hun and Glow, and then she's Queen Kong and Pow. Ninotchka went to Pow, right?
Yeah.
One of the first daughters, I'm sure.
Yeah.
She became Babe, right?
Yeah.
Or was Babe the one who was already No. Babe was her replacement, right?
Something like that.
The farmer's daughter that was in Glow became Brandy May and Pow.
Brandy May, that's right.
And then, though, Glow also starts to do their own gimmick changes around this time.
Well, yeah, Brandy May was Amy, the farmer's daughter in Glow.
Okay, thank you.
Goldie Ray was Babe, the farmer's daughter in Glow. And we had Hot Rod Andy, who was the former Angel in Glow. Insanity, the former Dementia. Jeannie Barret was the former Attaché in Glow.
So wait, when did Dementia become the Widow in Black in Glow?
Somewhere in that era.
After this or before this?
I guess after. Lady Soul.
So they went back to Glow?
Yeah, Lady Soul was NB in Glow. Malibu, of course, was California Doll in Glow. Natasha the Russian was Major Tanya in Glow. Nina was formerly Tina Ferrari in Glow. Of course, Nina would become Ivory. Then, yeah, Princess Jasmine was Pepper in Glow. Rockin' Rebel, not the great promoter in Pennsylvania, was Red Snapper in Glow. Sasha the Russian was formerly Dementia and Sugar in Glow. The Syrian Terrorist was formerly Palestina in Glow. And Tiffany Crystal was formerly Ashley Cartier in Glow. So there you go.
What a raid that we got going on there. That's more than I realized, actually.
Yeah, that's quite the list. And Pow was around until 1990. People don't know that. I mean, they lasted a while.
So there was there a period where Pow, Glow, LPWA, and Wild Women of Wrestling all coexisted?
Yes.
Huh.
1990. Yep.
Or if they didn't, it was close.
Yeah. Huh.
I'm still shocked Glow lasted 5 seasons. I mean.
They had a devoted fan base.
Yeah.
I remember to remember when it stopped. When I stopped seeing it, because, like, even if you didn't see it on TV anymore, you would know of it from, like, the Married with Children stuff or WCW versus Glow on Family Feud or whatever.
You mean Family Feud where we got...
You gotta give me a second. Hey, do it again.
Nice setup.
You know, on Family Feud where we got...
Coffee!
Yep.
Come on, coffee!
There you go. Yeah, Glow. Yeah, they stuck around for a while. No, it's crazy. Well, we've got some sad news here. July 4th, 1988, Adrian Adonis, David McKinney, and Pat Kelly all passed away as what was described as a gruesome van wreck in Newfoundland on the night of July 4th. According to Canadian Wire Service reports, the three wrestlers, along with Mike Kelly, another wrestler, were traveling in a minivan en route to a match in Lewisport, Newfoundland, which is an island on Canada's east coast, when the van crashed and went into a brook. The accident occurred at approximately 9:30 p.m., about 8 miles from Lewisport. One of the Kelly twins was the driver of the minivan, although Dave wasn't certain which one it was. They were driving through the glaring sun, because it doesn't get dark in that part of the world until 11 p.m., and the sun rises just a few hours later that time of year. Missed a turnoff and went into a lake. Mike Kelly and Adonis were thrown from the car while the car went into the lake. And McKegney, Canadian Wild Man, you may know him as, and Pat Kelly drowned in the vehicle. Mike suffered 2 badly crushed legs in the accident, but was the lone survivor, as Adonis died hours later in a Gander, Newfoundland hospital. The blood alcohol level in the body of the driver was 0.06, which is under the legal limit of 0.08. That's considered driving under the influence. 0.10 is the legal limit in the United States. Kelly underwent 8 hours of surgery to repair his legs, and it's doubtful he'll be able to wrestle again. Pat Kelly, whose real name was Victor Arco, and McKinney, best known as the Bear Man, a Canadian Wild Man, were pronounced dead at the scene while Adonis died hours later, about 60 miles from the scene of the accident. Adonis, 34 years old, was one of the most talented wrestlers in the world in the early part of the decade, and had been a tag team champion in AWA with Jesse Bonaventura and WWF with Dick Murdoch. And had just started back this past month in Japan, where he had been a major star before his recent WWF stint. McKinney, who was the main character in the recently published book Drawing Heat by Jim Friedman, was a longtime promoter and wrestler, mainly in the northern regions of Ontario, Canada. He was known in the 60s as the Bear Man, because he traced several wrestling bears. The book Drawing Heat brought up that McKinney had lived a tragic life, where the most publicized part of his life occurred many years back. One of the bears he trained escaped and killed his wife and ripped him up pretty good as well. Yeah, I remember seeing this on Pro Wrestling This Week, the week after it happened, and I was shocked.
I mean, that was the only wrestling show that acknowledged it, right?
Yeah, I was shocked because, you know, Adonis, you were hearing about him that he was losing, he lost weight, and he was, you know, back in Japan, and he's trying to get it together, and again, only 34 years old, still young, and his tragic ending to his life among the along with the other ones, Bigs. Just a bad way to go out.
And the beginning of the July 4th curse in wrestling, as it was called.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
He also had Brutus Beefcake. I'm trying to remember who else.
Joey Morella.
Right, yeah.
Which July 4th weekend. I feel like there's more, though. I have always found it weird, I mean, nothing against Bearman or his tours, that Adonis was on this tour in the first place. Given his
maybe he's doing us a favor.
At the time. What?
Maybe he's doing us a favor or something. I don't know. Who knows?
I guess. It is. I always thought it was a little weird because he's getting booked by New Japan again. He's back in shape. You would think. I mean, it is weird that he wasn't really working anywhere in the States at this point. That it's really just going back to New Japan and this tour.
What, I think, wasn't he supposed to wear Stampede or something like that?
Maybe.
Or that was in the pipeline going
something like that. Yeah, but always that was weird. But yeah, I mean, this shame and this is when you consider just the magnitude of the number of deaths and that one of them is such a big star and had been such a big star. Just, you know, he had been on AWA TV just a few months earlier and had been in one of the top matches at WrestleMania a little more over a year earlier. This is one of wrestling's darker moments in terms of not acknowledging a death.
Yeah, never acknowledged on WWF television. Should have been acknowledged. Never was. If this happened today, I mean, there would have been a huge uproar about it. But it's a different era.
Yeah, I mean, the last time they
really... After magazines and Pro Wrestling Suite, that was it.
Yeah, and the last time they really didn't acknowledge anyone that they probably should have was the whole Fez Wahoo controversy from 2002 or 2003 when they passed away. And they and then what? They did this little tribute. Well, it was like over a week later, right?
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Yeah. Adonis, Jeff, one of the all-time great workers, you know, for a guy his size and his look. I mean, he was just doing things that, you know, few could do.
Yeah, and it's a shame that he didn't get the chance to rehab the image because so many fans... You know, all they really knew it was the adorable Adrian character from WWF, which was, you know, started out okay and then became just terrible and a joke in and of itself. But, I mean, the nonchalance with the wording of they missed a turnoff and went into a lake. I'm just like, you hear about this stuff in the Canadian territories all the time. Because, I mean, there was a story about Edge and Christian driving in a van that, you know, all they had to do was drive over ice, and you're just like, what kind of road conditions do they have in this country that you're doing things like that? But no, I mean, if he had lost the weight, he had been on AWA briefly. I can't remember what was his feud there at the
Greg
time.
Gagne.
Greg Gagne, that's right.
And Wahoo. Yeah, because
this was the time.
Yeah, the knife on the Indian strap where they had the blood, because wasn't Adonis cut? Who was it Adonis got cut? It was Adonis or Wahoo that got cut bad?
I think it was Wahoo.
One of them got cut their hands really bad and was just bleeding all over the place. So, yeah, I mean, it's just the bad timing of everything, man. And it's just a sad way for those guys to go out, you know. That is terrible. And now let's close out with Jim Crockett Promotions. And a lot has changed in the past week regarding the possible sale of the NWA to the Turner Broadcasting Empire. Dave didn't really get into details because he's not totally clear of all of them, other than the JCP stockholders, basically the Crockett family, are not united in wanting to sell the company right now. Dave's not certain of who stands where other than Jim Crockett is behind the sale, And David isn't. And Ole Anderson is trying to become a key player in this deal as well, trying to sway the wrestlers into breaking away and either forming a new company, which could conceivably be headed by David Crockett, provided Jim Crockett makes a deal with Turner, or actually maneuvering a deal with Turner himself, which if Anderson could provide the wrestlers, in theory, that Turner wouldn't have to pay however many millions to the Crocketts to actually buy a company. Of course, none of this takes into account that any new company would have to start from scratch when it comes to putting together a national syndication network so it could promote. And this network would have to be started at a time when TV programmers are no longer hot on wrestling, not to mention all the disadvantages when it comes to booking the major arenas and building up an audience during these times when the wrestling economy is far from its healthiest point. It is expected that several more major breakthroughs will be taking place before this month is out, and what inevitably will wind up being the most important news story pro wrestling this year. Well, I'll say. Now, me and Biggs talked about this a lot on the 88 Death of Crockett show from Exile last year. Jeff, another, you know, part of this big story right here, it would have been interesting if, say, if Ole Anderson could have persuaded David Crockett to go with him, and they tried to, you know, get some of the main Crockett wrestlers to go along with this new venture, how different things could have been.
I don't know about that. Is Ole Anderson the guy you want heading the rah-rah chorus for the boys?
Not really.
To join him? I mean, that's the part that I go, yeah, I could just see all the guys going, sure, let's go with Ole, who he doesn't like anybody. At the time, I mean, I think it's so odd because when you're watching the product and at the time, you know, when you're this old, you just realize, okay, Crockett just took on Vince and had more buzz coming out of that show with the, even though it may not have done the same numbers, but they had more of the buzz in terms of the product. And you're, of course, they're going to believe that, well, maybe we're turning it around now if they're told that. I mean, it seems... You know, it seems like things might be okay. I could see people believing that, but I just, you know.
If you watch the television, you wouldn't know nothing's going on.
Exactly.
The television was still very good. Hot angles, you know, good, hot storylines. You wouldn't have known there was a lot of problems. You wouldn't know they'd be losing money like they're losing.
It's yeah, crazy. I just couldn't see, you know, and that's probably why they dragged their feet with Ole. I could see Crockett going, do we want this guy running on our company right now? Let's see if we can get a deal where, because inevitably Ole and the Crocketts would have had a falling out if they had joined together.
Well, but Ole and David, Jim wasn't wanting to sell. David wasn't. That's the whole thing. Yeah, David was not wanting to sell. Which, Big, so we can understand that. I mean, David, it seemed like David had the more of the passion anyway than Jimmy did.
Yeah, he never wanted to sell. And also, not only was Ole trying to make a presentation about bringing a promotion to TBS, but TBS was also negotiating with Global out of Florida, the penny stock scam company.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but that, who knows how serious that was, because they weren't really doing, Global was not even really doing anything at that time period.
That's the point.
Yeah, they didn't have anybody, anything.
And they were talking to World Class, too.
Yeah, they talked to World Class as well. But, yep, just another part of that big story. All right, the Great American Bash series opened up this week, and thus far it's drawn well. As pretty much expected. All the game matches and the Bash hype, making this a special card for each city, should result in good crowds. But, again, if the first week is any judgment, we aren't going to be seeing any $250,000 shows as past years to deliver. June 20th in Columbia drew a turnaway house. July 1st in Norfolk drew just over $100,000. July 2nd in Charlotte, the baseball stadium drew 98,000 and around 10,000 fans, much lower than they had done previous years for Bash shows, which in the past had drawn more than 20,000. And on July 3rd in Amarillo, they drew a near sell as well, more than 6,000 fans. Now, the Charlotte show, was that?
Oh, I was going to say, I was at the 7-1 show in Norfolk.
Okay. Talk about it.
Because this is my home area, and I can tell you why business was going down in Norfolk. They killed Norfolk every year when they came around, because they just, it seems like they didn't know the makeup of the city of Norfolk when it came to doing Starcades, because this, Norfolk is an urban location. You still had, you know, the poor white cross section with Chesapeake and whatnot, but you also had the young urban set, and they're not going to come to see, say, David Allan Coe was there 2 years ago. That's not big on them. And but they also, Norfolk really wanted a war games. And Norfolk never got the war games in these previous years. The time we got the war games was 91, when we got one of those weird ones with One Man Gang and Elegante.
Yellow Dog.
And the Yellow Dog and things of that nature. But I mean,
now,
the year.
Wasn't the special thing on this show Magnum?
Yes, because this is Magnum's home area. Magnum's from Chesapeake.
Yeah, he was always the special thing.
Yeah, they would always do the special thing. He was the guest ref in that War Games I talked about. And here they did the homage between – they did Dusty and Tully in an I Quit match. And then they did a cage match with the rest of the Horsemen versus Sting, Luger, and the Road Warriors. But the year before, the card was just dreadful. I mean, it was a two-match card. They had it was nothing but like squash matches for the first like eight matches, and then they had, I guess, the Garvins against the Midnight Express, and then they had the Horsemen versus the Superpowers and the Road Warriors. But it wasn't, I mean, it was always seemed like Norfolk was that night before a big show in either Greensboro or Charlotte. So it was always a night off for the guys, it would seem, because it was booked like that. Like in 87, there were like two Thunderfoot matches in there. I think Nelson Royal faced one of them at that time. Let me pull it up here. I got it real quick.
I got it. Here we go. Mark Fleming. Gladiator.
Yeah, Nelson Mark Fleming was a local guy.
Yeah, Nelson Royal over Thunderfoot 2, Lasertron over Thunderfoot 1, Mod Squad over Tagestay and a Todd Champion, Manny Fernandez over Rocky King, Barbarian over Kim the Windham, Paul Ellering over Paul Jones in a bunkhouse match, Robert Gibbs over Sean Royal, the Garvins over the Midnights by DQ, and then the Superpowers and Road Warriors over the Horsemen in the cage match. I guess they're looking at that. They're looking at that as a two-match card.
Yeah, this is the Great American Bash on Tour that we're supposed to get hyped about, and they gave us that for.
And they were in Tallahassee as well that night. So the other part of the crew was in Florida.
Yeah. And so going into this match, I mean, going into this year, it's not a surprise that business was a little bit down.
Yeah, I mean, and business was down anyway. You know, across the board. So
yeah,
it wasn't just Norfolk. Now, the Charlotte show on July 2nd saw the Lightning Express and Bugsy McGraw over Cruel Connection 1, Gary Royal, Chris Champion, and Tiger Conway Jr. Vix, that's a war six-man tag team. When Horner pinned Cruel Connection 1, Gary Royal, Chris Champion, and Tiger Conway Jr.
Sure.
Jim Guccaro was not booking this.
At least the Lightning Express got Bugsy as opposed to Mighty Wilbur, who
we got. You know why they got in this match? Because Ron Simmons and Jimmy Vann no-showed.
Yeah.
So there you go. Larry Zbyszko pinned Kendall Windham in a good match. Al Perez pinned Mighty Wilbur in a four-minute dud.
Oh, jeez.
Ronnie Garvin pinned Rick Steiner in a tape fist match, which sounds awesome. When Kevin Sullivan threw an object in the ring, Garvin intercepted it and KO'd Steiner for the pin. Rock and Rolls beat the Sheepherders in a match where the first 7 minutes were terrible, but got pretty good at the end.
Same as Norfolk.
Jimmy Garvin pinned Kevin Sullivan in a Prince of Darkness match, which was atrocious.
Same as Norfolk.
2-on-3 Bunkhouse match. Fantastics beat Midnights and Jim Cornette, which was entertaining. Mm-hmm. NWA World TV title match. Dr. Death over Mike Rotunda by DQ with the famous Dusty finish. When there's a ref bump, Williams hit the Oklahoma Stampede. Apparently won the title. Ref rolled Rotunda in him first. After a second ref, I counted the pin. The result was a DQ. God, you got to love that finish. Road Warriors beat Russian Assassin Nikolov in the Skywalkers match, which lasted less than 5 minutes. In the War Games, which was an excellent match, saw the babyfaces of Dusty, Nikita, Luger, Sting, and Paul Ellering over the Horsemen and J.J. Dillon when Luger made Dillon submit to the torture rack. Dave Allen Coe played on the show as well. Overall, Dave was told it was a good show, but not a great show.
David Allen Coe, one of the oddest concert experiences I've ever had.
Dave Allen Coe, I love Dave Allen Coe, but I know that he is a different cat.
1991 in college, I went to see David Allen Coe, and a buddy of mine had talked me into going. And I
did you see him at? Should I give an idea of what kind of concert you got?
It was at a place called Trax in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Okay. Did he do his infamous album?
He didn't do anything. Here's what happened. He shows up 45 minutes late, drunk, plays a few notes on the, it sounds like he's trying to go into the ride. but yeah. We don't know what he's going into. Tells us all to fuck off and leaves. And that's the concert.
Awesome. Well, Dave Allen Co. has an album of nothing but racial songs. I mean, In Fucker, all songs like that. It's all over YouTube. You can check it out. Well, whenever he has come to George in the past, he would do these special shows in Ellijay, Georgia, which is up in North Georgia, where he would do that album. Knowing that places like that is the only place he could really get away with doing that because there are hardly any blacks that live up in that area. And it's all rednecks. And yeah, it's wild. those songs are wild. Dale Lanco is something else, man. He has something else. But yeah, go check out Dale Lanco on YouTube. I mean, if you're easily offended, don't. But yeah. If you don't care, go he's look an, up
some he's of an songs. Important part of, let's put it this way, he's an important part of outlaw country. But
oh, he is outlaw country, for sure.
Yeah.
There is no doubt about that. All right. John Gallagher, again, wrote in the Wrestling Forum that Dusty is doing a commercial for Mellow Yellow, a soft drink that features pictures of NWA stars on the side of his cans. For some reason, he's holding the U.S. belt in the commercial. So this could be the NWA's equivalent of foreshadowing a title change, a la Randy Savage's win at WrestleMania. This week, a second commercial appeared and has Dusty's name superimposed at the bottom, and below that it says U.S. Heavyweight Champion. Now, these commercials aired on Turner. I mean, I just watched the show in August 28th. Episode of World Championship Wrestling. And they're still airing that commercial then.
Yeah, and Mellow Yellow's sponsoring one of these other promotions we
USA.
Watched.
USA Wrestling.
Yeah, because their branding's all over the ring apron at the time.
And Mellow Yellow, for those of you who don't know what that is, that's
it's great.
Coke's version of like Mountain Dew. And I love Mellow Yellow. It's awesome. They've redone their logo and shit like that, but Bix, I don't think that was the deal. I think they just shot the commercials when he was a champion. I mean, what do you think about that?
But it's wrestling. Would you really rely on that? I mean, it's most likely the answer. Or Dusty just said, screw it, I'm going to be the U.S. champion in this commercial. One or the other. I mean, I don't think he was planned to get the title.
Well, he never lost the title.
Right. No, I mean, from it during this time.
Yeah, he never lost a title. See, win them beat him at the Bash. That made win them the undisputed U.S. heavyweight champion. But, as Jim Ross said, Dusty lost his belt in the boardroom, not in the ring. So, I guess that's a way out of explaining it.
Sure.
All right. The pay-per-view clearances for the Baltimore Bash have topped the 10 million mark, which puts it in the same ballpark as WrestleMania 4 when it comes to total clearances. They'll probably do at least half the orders on pay-per-view that WrestleMania did. I say what's funny. I watched one of these World Championship Wrestlings from right before that pay-per-view, and they had a guy from Turner Home Entertainment do a special promo announcing this stat. I'm thinking to myself, how many wrestling fans actually care about this at this time period, that they've cleared this many homes?
One in Campbell, California.
It was just so weird to see that. I mean, they're promoting it being on pay-per-view and trying to, and I love that they were trying to tell people how to order it. Did you see that, Jeff? All the time they're trying to describe it.
If your cable company, you say your cable company is closed on Saturday and Sunday, there's a certain button on your box that you can press, and it's. My favorite was they also on one of these TVs for the Houston Bash or Dallas. For the Dallas one, they were plugging the air conditioning in Reunion Arena.
Oh, yes. You know why that was? Because Gary Hart was buried in the Sportatorium.
Yeah.
The Sportatorium didn't have air conditioning. So, yeah, they were doing that. Yeah, it's awesome.
And in that same promo, he almost blurts the name Kevin Von Erich. He goes, Kevin Von? And he goes, Kevin Sullivan? Because he's talking about the Tower of Doom match.
Yeah. Yeah. And Jim Ross as well says, if you like good air conditioning in Dallas, come to Reunion Arena.
Yeah. It's so surreal. It's like you're plugging the way to get people into your arena to watch your wrestling. Is it the stars? And it's not that Gary Hart and Al Perez are from Dallas. Nope. Come to the very cool air conditioning in Reunion Arena where the Dallas Mavericks play.
That's outstanding. I just watched that. I loved it. And Gary Hart talking about this is the only true wrestling in Texas and stuff like that. Oh, he's spitting it out, spitting hot fire out of World Class. All right, back to Wrestling Forum. It was noted by John Gallagher that ticket prices for the Baltimore Bash are scaled from $30 to the first few rows to $10. The fans of Baltimore should turn out and be very vocal. Gary Juster is a local promoter, and he always tries to go the extra mile for his fans there. And they know it and usually show it. The only problem he has with the hype for the pay-per-view so far is the commercial they show on TBS for it features Barbarian slamming a chair against Road Warrior Hawk's back. Bad timing. Well, Bix, this is the history of Crockett and WCW. You always got to have some type of mistakes on television.
Yep.
Well, they totally no-sold that, too, because didn't J.J. Dillon cut a promo about how all the tickets in Baltimore were gone? You can't buy any more tickets.
Yeah. They pretty much sold out. I mean, it was a sold-out show, if I'm not mistaken, wasn't it, Bix?
I guess.
Close enough. It was a pretty packed.
It was their best city.
Yeah, they did fantastic business in Baltimore. There was some unhappiness among the crews. This word was given that the payoffs for the Baltimore Bash won't be arriving for several months. Which we talked about that on the Jeff Crockett show. October 1st was the date given, which was an interesting date in other ways in the future, wasn't it? But this is the reason why Robert Gibson quit. Robert Gibson quit when the Rock and Roll was supposed to come back. He quit late in July because he didn't get the payoffs.
Yeah, and he really wanted to get paid, so he went to the AWA.
And worked like World Class and other places too, but...
Well, pay became the factor in why Tully and Arn also left, because they found out Paul Ellering's getting paid more.
Oh, yeah. But, again, more on that stuff on the Death of Crockett show on Exxon Bad Street from last year, because it was... a lot of stuff going on with those paydays, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's it for this show. Jeff, what's going on Shake Them Ropes this week?
This week, probably more of the same, previewing Raw, and then also anything that goes on with the draft, perhaps, and also Battleground coming up. Probably more Roman Reigns talk than I'd like.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
And then once SmackDown goes live, I'll be on with Sean Ross Sapp over at his new venture at Fightful after live after SmackDown on Tuesdays. I'll be doing the breakdown of that over there.
There you go. Yeah. Bix's good buddy, Sean Ross Sapp, with his new venture over there. Speaking of new ventures, Bix, talk to us about the law.
So, yeah, each week I'll be on live audio wrestling. No. Lawnews.com. I already did this at the beginning.
I know. Just mention it again.
Okay, good. Good.
Lawnews.com. That is right. And 605 Super Podcast. First in show this week with the author of the Dick the Bruiser book.
Yeah, we had Richard Vyshek on to talk about his book about Dick the Bruiser. We had Jim Cornette doing commentary on an interesting squash match from Eddie Einhorn's IWA.
Rip Hawk.
Yes, Rip Hawk against, what's the guy's name again? Billy Jackson.
Yep.
We had another Super Pod Rumble. We had Brian Trammell back for another Dennis of the Week. So all that's at 605pod.com. And, Follow me on Twitter, at David Bix. Anything else? What do you got?
Jeff, Twitter, you are?
CrapGame13.
There you go. Follow Jeff. He always has interesting takes. of course, I'm at Chris Zellner, KRISZELNER, and the latest episode of Exile on Bad Street dropped over the weekend, and the last of our Continental series. Me and Bo James talking about the last 6 months of Continental Wrestling Federation, and really, really good show. Of course, the one thing that everybody has been talking about is the Robert Fuller Kerry Von Erich story, which you have to hear, because it is phenomenal. And just talking about other things that was going on, what should have happened, what could have happened. And plus, Bo gives his thoughts on the best and worst in the history of the Continental promotion. So really strong stuff. And now that I'm free of that, Exile goes back to doing whatever. So we'll see what we can come up with next in the future. Between the Sheets, next week, we'll cover 1994. And interesting week here, as this is the beginning of the WWF steroid trial, folks. Yep. So Vince is, you got to get some prime visit man here. And also other things going on. WCW goes live on Sunday night and on July 9th. And New Japan and AAA hooking up. So there's a lot of interesting things going on for that week. So check that out then. But Jeff, thank you for being on the show. And we'll definitely have you back in the future. Bix, of course. Without you, there is no show. So we always thank you. And Chris saying so long from the Peach State of Georgia.
In my dreams, it's still the same. Your love is strong.